Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. I want to give some background to this video that you're about to see and related matters. It's been my intention for quite some time to haul out my African Crisis archive. African Crisis was the original website that I began doing my activism on. I ran it for a very long time and it went through various phases. There was a phase right in the beginning in the year 2000 when I did an experiment with another guy and we ran a tiny little website for about 3 months and we called it Issues. And on this little Issues website we actually did some stuff about the farm invasions in Zimbabwe. Then we parted company, and more than a year later, I came back and I started a website, and I called it Government by Deception originally. But I then turned it into African Crisis, and African Crisis underwent several versions. And it went through various phases and it sort of terminated in late 2011 and sometime in 2012. But it wasn't like a permanent termination. Then I came back with yet another version of African Crisis, which contained several other websites, including a website called History Reviewed. And these ran from about 2012 to 2014. So there were several different versions and I rewrote the programs and I did different things to the databases. In total, there were about 4 different versions of African Crisis. But one of the biggest changes was African Crisis version 2, which came out in 2007-2008. So anyway, by the time I stopped doing African Crisis and my websites in about 2014, it had gone through several versions and I'd also had problems with some of the conversions. So my data was lying in all sorts of different places. So what I did now in the last 4 to 6 weeks is I decided to actually haul out the oldest database that I can find, which is from 2001 to late in 2011, and to try to put it in a form that I can actually search through it and I can view those articles for the first time in well over a decade. And so that I can see what did I have and what can be put together. I also at a point wrote articles for another website that ran for a while and that was quite popular for a time called Etherzone. It was an American website. And those articles don't exist anywhere. They merely exist as copies on a disk. So what I was really hunting for, and the reason I went through this huge exercise, was because I wanted to get to my P.W. Botha data. Because this is about President P.W. Botha of South Africa. He is the last true loyal white president of South Africa. He is different to F.W. de Klerk, the clown, weakling, and traitor who handed over the country to the blacks needlessly. So what I was hunting for was really my P.W. Botha data. I've got it in different forms, but I published a bunch of stuff on my website in the year 2006. In a nutshell, in April of 2006, I managed to make contact with P.W. Botha. That in and of itself is a separate story that I will tell in another video. But I managed to make contact with him, and one of the problems I've had all the time, regardless of what my views were at the time, one problem I've always had is that politicians and people in high places don't talk to me. They don't talk to me because I'm probably too direct. I'm putting out information that is too borderline. Borderline in the sense that it's going to step on all kinds of people's toes, and they don't want that stuff to come back and burn them. So I never, for example, had Rhodesians or army officers, except for a handful, who would give me information and be publicly associated with me. So this is where P.W. Botha is very unique for me. And I have a soft spot for him because he was the only high-ranking person that I could approach, and he actually talked back to me, and he started phoning me, and he didn't mind that if I wrote something about him on my website, he didn't mind it at all. In fact, he liked it. And he started talking to me more and more, and eventually he invited me to stay at his house for 5 days. But I had been busy since 2001 fighting my fight for the truth on the internet, initially focusing on the whites of Zimbabwe and the blacks, smashing them, taking their land, destroying them, etc. That is what my original motivation was. And then from there, I started writing about South African stuff, about the wars, about the history, etc. So my association with P.W. Botha started in April 2006. Then he started phoning me and we started talking, and he would tell me stuff and I would write articles about it on my website. His wife was very active on the internet. And his wife would actually go to my website, print out the articles, give it to him to read. He was 90 years old at this point, so he wasn't interested in going onto the internet and surfing the web, etc. He would sit in his house, his wife would print off the stuff, he would read it, and he would pass comments. And later he would phone me. And he'd tell me stuff, and he would also check the stuff that I was writing. And he liked my accuracy. He liked the fact that whatever he told me, I wrote it up properly, and I didn't use journalist license. I didn't massage what he told me. I wrote exactly what he told me. And then I went to visit him, I think in October of 2006. And shortly after I came back, 11 days after I left his home, he was dead. And that was the end of it. So between April and the beginning of November, I had contact with him, I visited him, I've got photographs and notes of discussions. And then he was dead. And these things will be discussed in a separate video. This video was made in January of 2006. It is one of a number of videos that were made by these people. These people actually did interviews with two people before they died. The other person is Ian Smith of Rhodesia. And they made a video about him where they referred to him as a rebel. I've seen bits and pieces of that video, and I personally don't like it much. They actually have more film footage that has never been published of Ian Smith. But at a point, they decided they would also do a video about P.W. Botha. They would do an interview with him because, in the case of P.W. Botha, he was let's call it the last real president of white South Africa, and Ian Smith was the last white leader of white Rhodesia. And with regard to the Ian Smith video, I've never seen the full Ian Smith video. I've only seen bits and pieces of it. Now, the big problem with Ian Smith, and also even with P.W. Botha and the whites, is that as white power waned and went away, and our history was rewritten, we were now being portrayed as the bad guys, as the losers, as the weaklings, etc. In the case of South Africa, this couldn't be further from the truth. In the case of Rhodesia, the fighting started getting heavy and the whites started surrendering, but that's a whole other thing. In the case of Rhodesia, there was stress, there was military stress, and there was a lot of pressure before the whites just quit. And it focused on the military stuff. In South Africa, that is not true at all. Not true at all. The whites in South Africa actually won the war and had the whole military thing totally under control. Nobody at any time will ever tell you that the white South Africans won all their wars. All of them. Every one of them. They even won wars that you've never heard them talk about. And we will return to that and we can look at that because I discussed this in a talk I gave a few years ago. I will be publishing that talk as well shortly. We're going to go through a whole bunch of stuff and I'm going to start clearing up a whole lot of things that you have not heard about. I will haul out various interviews and talks and things and then you can observe and look at the situation yourself. South Africa's handover was a different kind of a thing. The South Africans were not under military pressure to hand over, but they were under other pressures. So let me just make a few comments because you're going to hear some interesting things in this video. Now, in this video where P.W. Botha is interviewed, when they interviewed him, they did an interview in Afrikaans and an interview in English. In this video, you will get both. You will first get the English interview so that the non-Afrikaans speakers can listen to it and understand it. Then there's going to be the Afrikaans interview. Both of them cover the same topics. However, Afrikaans is his, let's call it, mother language. And he is much more comfortable in Afrikaans. So he starts saying more things in the Afrikaans interview. And he goes into greater depth on some things. So I will act as the interpreter of the Afrikaans section. And what I will do is I will summarize some of the key points that are important in the Afrikaans section that the English speakers need to hear. But the English speakers will be able to understand the first part and they will go through the first section of it, the English section, and you will see them touch on those topics, but I will add the things that he elaborates on in the Afrikaans section. One of the things I want to mention in this English portion relates to a thing called the total onslaught. But I also want to set the context. When I started my website, and at the time that I was doing these things, I was not yet awakened to the issues pertaining to Jews, the Holocaust, etc. So in this period, I was what you could call a conservative, and I was pro-Christian, I was pro-Israel, I was pro-Jew. And you will see that P.W. Botha himself was in a sort of similar state of mind. He was pro-Israel, etc. But in my personal discussions with him, he started talking about Israel. And he was starting to tell me things that he doesn't say in here. And he was telling me things which didn't make sense to me at the time. So those are things that we're going to deal with in a separate video. And I will show you some things that he said that went over my head at the time. It meant nothing to me. I didn't understand the significance. This interview was originally intended to be broadcast on South African state television, the SABC. It would have been broadcast to the entire country, including the blacks. All the non-whites would have heard this interview. So when they did this, it's a kind of a soft thing. They did it for a multiracial audience. So it's not as hard-hitting as it could have been. But even what is in here would have stirred up a storm among the liberals, among the blacks, and government, etc. And this original interview was ultimately stopped. They decided to never broadcast this in South Africa. So the people who made it created a website for P.W. Botha, and they sold it off that website. That website no longer exists. So in here, you will find references that are like anti-Nazi, pro-Jew, pro-Israel, conservative, pro-Christian, deeply Christian, etc. You will also find lots of guilt tripping, where the slightest hint of anything improper puts P.W. Botha on his back foot. You've got to understand that these people are deeply Christian. They took their job very seriously, and they ruled South Africa strictly according to the law, down to the letter of the law. So they didn't officially engage in all kinds of wild, nasty stuff. But some of their people in the military and the police got up to some naughty stuff. So they themselves, at a high level, never really want to say that they gave an order for something. And they very likely probably never did. But exactly how the chain of command got to the naughty stuff and how it was done, that's a whole other issue. What I will say is that a lot of that stuff is highly overblown. It's taken massively out of context. And it doesn't take into account the fact that there was a war. It doesn't take into account that the blacks were doing far worse things than this. They were busy torturing other people to death, carrying out acts of terrorism, setting people on fire, doing all kinds of nasty, nasty things, breaking every moral code known to man. The blacks were arming children. They were giving guns to children. They were getting children to kill adults. They were doing all kinds of things. They were doing things that you never heard about. But the liberal mass media and the communists are always attacking the whites. And they will attack the whites for the slightest little thing. So they'll say, oh, you guys are busy murdering people in Vlakplaas and this and that and here and there. So the whites are very much on the defensive of these issues. Though, when I look at it, I say, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If it was right for the blacks to go and slaughter other people and cut them to pieces and torture them to death, torture even their own people, then why couldn't the whites go and beat someone up and torture somebody, etc.? But when you are looking at this from the Christian paradigm, the Christians are like, no, 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 God, we didn't do this and we didn't want to do this. What you've got is you've got a enemy that has no moral code fighting another enemy that's got a totally moral code. And so now the whites get bashed constantly over them not applying their moral code, while the blacks had no moral code at all. In here, a critically important thing you've got to listen to is P.W. Buerter talks about a thing called the total onslaught. One of the big problems with South African history is that you never really find the whites coming out and aggressively defending themselves, aggressively getting up and defending themselves. They are always busy making sure that they did everything by the book, that they didn't do anything wrong, etc., etc. A huge problem with the whites at all times is that the whites are bound by rules that don't allow them any room for maneuver, especially in a war where there are no rules. In war and deception and murder and terrorism, there are no rules, but they are constantly abiding by rules. So it puts them in a spot and they do their best. But anyway, I want you to listen carefully. He talks about a thing called the total onslaught. He mentions that this same thing was working against Rhodesia, and it was also working against the Portuguese colonies of Angola and Mozambique. So he's telling you that the same thing was happening to all these whites, that the same method of warfare, communism, was coming and hitting us. And he will talk about the Russians, he will talk about the Cubans. He will also talk about the Americans. And he will talk about the Americans, you know, as being the good guys, we're on the side of America, blah, 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 and we are talking to the Americans, and we're up against the Russians and the Cubans. And he'll even talk about the CIA. But the key element is the total onslaught. And he tells you a little bit about it, but you will never really find the white South Africans actually going out and aggressively defending themselves. The white South Africans basically lost the war of words a long time ago. And they lost it decades before they lost political power. In the war of words, the liberal media inside South Africa was already knifing the whites in the back, including these Boers. Now, another term that I just want to clarify, because it's come up so many times, there are people who've come up with this issue of the term Boer and the term Afrikaner. And I just want to clarify, because for many months now, I've been looking and digging into Southern African stuff and hauling out my archives, etc. And I just want to clarify this whole thing. If you watch this video in the English and the Afrikaans section, you will hear the interviewer and President Buerter talking about the Afrikaners. The Afrikaners. Never at any time will you hear the term Boer, except on one occasion. The only time you will hear the term Boer is when you hear them talking about the Anglo-Boer War, the time when the British fought the Boers. P.W. Buerter is himself obviously a Boer, and most of these people that are referred to as Afrikaners are actually Boers, okay? But you'll never hear them say that in this entire interview. In fact, I've been reading books, I've been looking at other documentaries, etc. And I want to tell you that never will you find the term Boer being used during the time of apartheid. The people who used to be the Boers never call themselves Boers. And you will see P.W. Botha himself, his father was a Boer who fought in the Anglo-Boer War, but he will never call himself a Boer. And then at a point he reads a passage that was written by Arthur Conan Doyle, the famous British author and creator of Sherlock Holmes. And Arthur Conan Doyle writes a very lovely piece about the Boers. Interestingly enough, in Arthur Conan Doyle's description of the racial makeup of the Boers, he describes them as being made up of Dutch and French. He never discusses the Germans, because German DNA is in there as well, okay? Much more German in there than French. But anyway, he will read this piece from Arthur Conan Doyle, which describes the Boers. But listen to him talk about us and everything and our culture and our language and everything, and he just says Afrikaners. Both of them talk about Afrikaners. And if you go and you watch any videos from the time of apartheid where any of the previous prime ministers and presidents talk, they only describe the Afrikaans-speaking people, the Boers mainly, they only describe everybody as Afrikaner. They say, we Afrikaners, we the Afrikaners and the English. So you will find that the term Boer is not used to apply to the current people. The term Boer disappears after the Boers lose the Anglo-Boer War. Later on, it's replaced by this term Afrikaner. So P.W. Botha and his whole family are classically and clearly Boers, as are all the other people that they're talking to and that are in government with them, but never at any time do they actually call themselves that. But when they talk about their ancestors, then they'll use the term Boer. So one of the strange things you'll find about South African history is the following. You will see that the people that we know as the Boers, that when those people left the Cape Colony and they started going out to try and get countries for themselves, they are called voortrekkers. So these are known as the voortrekkers at that point in time. And you'll see that the whole history of everything they do, whether they fight at the Battle of Blood River, whether they go and create other republics, they constantly refer to themselves as voortrekkers. And voortrekkers are basically pioneers. But the moment they've got their Boer republics and they're living in their Boer republics, then they refer to themselves as the Boers. And then afterwards, when the British and the Boers agree to create this entity called South Africa, it is somewhere in that time that the term Boer starts disappearing. So among the questions is, why did people who were clearly Boers stop using the term Boer during the time of apartheid? And I don't know the full answer. But there are lots and lots and lots of people who were in positions of power who, if you look at their ancestry, you'll see that they were Boers. So you have all these people who are directly descended from Boers, but they never call themselves Boers. So just be aware that voortrekker, Boer and Afrikaner can all mean the same people. Then there's the whole issue of, is Afrikaner originally something else? But the real confusing thing in the time of apartheid is that everybody calls themselves Afrikaners, including people who clearly are Boers. So I just am trying to make that clear because it's a big nuisance of a thing. But watch the interview, you'll see that everybody is called an Afrikaner. It may be that now, after black rule, that there are whites who are starting to dig deeper into their past and they are realizing, well, you know, we are Boers, okay? And we don't need to call ourselves anything else. We are actual descendants of the Boers. Like in my case as well, my mom and my dad are Boers. They were born in the Boer Republics. Their parents were Boers, okay? So, you know, the truth is, these people are Boers. I just want to return to the issue of whites of South Africa lost a lot of the propaganda war. They were inundated, even from inside South Africa, from, let's call it, the liberal mass media that was working against them. So they lost a lot of the war of words a long time ago, decades ago. And so they never are really able to truly defend themselves. There was one attempt to defend themselves, and it's known as the information scandal. It is mentioned in here. We will return to the information scandal. It is absolutely a disgusting thing that took place, and the whites themselves have to apologize for doing something that they really needed to do because they were in a situation where the whole world was at war with them and they couldn't get a chance to get their message out. And I personally see nothing wrong with the information scandal. But they will talk like it was some huge crime that they were committing. But when you see it in its context of the actual war, then you'll realize they are just trying to get their message out. In the age of the internet, you could say it's the same as the government trying to put up their own website to push out their own propaganda because, let's say, CNN and all the others can't be trusted. It's nothing more than that. But you'll see all of them on their back feet. Oh, no, you know, we had this problem and it shouldn't have been done and blah, blah, blah. But when you see what they were trying to do, they were actually trying to purchase an American newspaper. That's really the crime. The whole information scandal is nothing more than the fake crime of trying to purchase an American newspaper secretly so that they can put out their news story in America. Something which you know who is doing all across the world. You know who does this in every single country on earth. But when the whites of South Africa do it, it's a scandal, it's a crime, it's wrong, it's evil. So much bullshit. It's all bullshit, okay? Okay, so here is the English interview. And the next time you'll hear from me is after the English interview. I will quickly summarize some of the critical things discussed in the Afrikaans interview so that the English speakers who can't understand Afrikaans can then stop the video and leave. And then those who want to listen to the Afrikaans part can listen to that in the final portion.
Some of his most treasured memorabilia. Shown to me at his home by former South African State President P.W. Botha only some 2 months before his 90th birthday on January the 12th, 2006. For much of more than half a century in politics, Pieter Willem Botha left deep footprints in the shaping of South Africa's highly controversial history, until the 15th of August 1989, when he resigned as state president following a stormy and acrimonious meeting with his cabinet. Given the upcoming advent of P.W. Botha's 90th birthday, plus a request by the South African Broadcasting Corporation for biographic-type interviews, Mark Williams of Tutuka Productions asked me to request of the aging Botha something which he had declined to do for about a decade. Lengthy Afrikaans and English interviews for television, which would be of a legacy nature, befitting a man of his age. He agreed. The interviews were done and submitted. The SABC at first readily accepted the English version for screening on P.W. Botha's birthday, but on reflection, it was rejected. Despite their apparent historical significance, this controversial man and his controversial interviews met the same fate with other television stations. Earlier, we had been requested by the SABC to find out what PW's favourite song was for the proposed birthday broadcast. Today, P.W. Botha lives in the wilderness, fulfilling a long-standing promise he made to the George constituency, which he served for so many years. It is also why he called his house the Anchor, thereby stating that this is where I dropped anchor after retirement, and this is where I intend staying. Although entitled to police protection, Mr. Botha lives a relatively modest life, in a house best described as comfortable. His much younger wife, Barbara, is a devoted and energetic companion, and she briefly gave us her insights into a man who led this country for 10 years.
P.W. is a complete man. He's the most balanced, the strongest man, person I have ever met in my life.
And a loving person.
Yes.
Not a
herd
crocodile.
Not a herd crocodile.
We asked PW about the origins of the popular nickname Groot Krokodil or Big Crocodile.
Ek het nie vaste benul nie, is miskien mense wat my bynaam wil gee of etiket wil gee. Ek het wel 'n bynaam en dit is die van PW, PW. Ja. Dit het ontstaan aan die universiteit waar my Engelse professor altyd van PW gepraat het.
Ja, maar u voel u het geen affiniteit met 'n groot krokodil nie?
Nee, inteendeel, ek is bang vir 'n krokodil.
Born on the 12th of January 1916 on the farm Telegraaf in the Paul Roo district in the then Free State, this young Botha had no idea then that he would be leading a controversial country during many of its most controversial and difficult years, and that his destiny was to be that of a leader with a high public profile. PW was a hard worker, to whom the dictum applies, the heights by great men reached and kept were not attained in sudden flight, but they, while their companions slept, were toiling upward in the night. But was he a great man, or was he a harsh ruler intent on entrenching white domination in South Africa? We pick up on the main interview, PW's voice from the wilderness.
Mr. Botha, how are you keeping? I'm asking this not just as a polite routine question, But back in 1989, after you had suffered a minor stroke, your cabinet requested that you resign for reasons of health, they said. Well, some 15 years later, many clods have fallen on many coffins in many cemeteries, and here you still are.
Yes, by the grace of God, I'm still around.
And how are you feeling?
No, I don't feel bad, and I'm still quite good health, and I'm looking forward for the rest of the life to continue with my activities.
Did you feel then and now that you were unfairly treated by the cabinet? And were there ulterior motives behind persuading you to resign? I read somewhere that you had said to them that you at least had a certificate proving your health, while they did not. And you wondered how many of them had pills in their pockets. So, Mr. Botha, was there something sinister behind it all?
After the so-called light stroke, I requested the man in Pretoria, Dr. Meiberg, he was the head of the Medical Institute. I requested him to come down here to Wilderness with his instruments and come and examine me. And after he stayed here for 2 days, he said, "I don't agree with the light stroke idea. Go on with your work, you're in good health." I stayed then in Cape Town, in Rondebosch, as president, and only in August of 1989 did the showdown take place at that specific cabinet meeting.
So why did the cabinet meeting take place? Was there something sinister behind it all?
According to those minutes, Mr. de Klerk and a few other members of the cabinet were cooperating with each other to tell me that they think I must go.
You think Mr. de Klerk at that stage had the ambition to become the next president?
I think so.
During a break in the interview, Mr. Botha showed us some of his memorabilia. The cannon was a gift from the Defence Force in commemoration of the 14 years he spent as Minister of Defence. He regarded those years as the best in his life and was extremely proud of the strength of the Defence Force.
We were respected by the Defence Forces of France, Great Britain, and even Israel, and Israel has a good Defence Force.
Why did you think we needed such an incredibly strong Defence Force?
To a certain extent, we introduced national service to train young men in various directions of life. And secondly, we had to protect our borders and from terrorism. And thirdly, the Defence Force inspired the nation as a whole.
There are those who say that the need for a strong Defence Force had to do with P.W. Botha's obsession with what he called the total onslaught against South Africa. So I asked him how serious the onslaught actually was.
It wasn't an obsession on my part. I had advice by several senior officers in the Defence Force and strategists in South Africa, and that they advised me that taking into account the actions of Russia and Cuba and some of the Western nations, there was an onslaught against Southern Africa, not only South Africa, but Southern Africa, including Rhodesia and the Portuguese territories. And that total onslaught had to be dealt with by way of opposition on our part or positive actions to try and convince people that this onslaught is dangerous.
We invaded Angola in support of Dr. Jonas Savimbi. Was that necessary?
We had an agreement on military intelligence part with the CIA that we would mine, they would mine Luanda Harbor while we helped Savimbi to attack the forces, the MPLA forces in Luanda. Well, there the actual cooperation took place. And eventually, with things rapidly moving from one day to the other, the American Congress decided that President Ford would not be allowed to mine further the Luanda Harbor. Then the Cubans were brought in by Russia. And we fought the Cubans.
Mr. Botha, did we not eventually actually drop Savimbi? I remember former Foreign Minister Pik Botha promising Savimbi at a huge rally in Jomba, and only after he had asked me to switch off my television cameras, that South Africa would support UNITA all the way into Luanda. That never happened, and why not?
What happened was that the decision of the American Congress. The American Congress took that fatal decision to prohibit President Ford to carry out his promises. Kissinger played a role in the whole affair. And afterwards, Dr. Kissinger came to Pretoria and he apologized to me for not having carried out his promises.
Did he explain why they?
Well, he said renamed. The Congress decided that way. I said, well, you left us in the lurch. Don't hide behind the Congress. You know that you didn't carry out your promise. And then we decided to withdraw our forces southwards. And we then advised Savimbi to fight guerrilla warfare.
In his book on extracts from P.W. Botha speeches, Scholz quotes a 1988 address to the House of Assembly in which Mr. Botha says,
"It is unfortunate that Americans have one set of rules for themselves and another for other people."
In fact, back in 1979, he also lambasted the West, declaring,
"Is it not a fact that of the concept the West as we knew it in the past, as countries that were characterized by honorable government and a fixed course of international affairs, almost nothing remains? There is no counter-strategy. There is a shuffling and a stumbling from one blunder to the next. The West is being ousted from all over the globe."
At former Rhodesia, while compiling a documentary on that country, I was told by officers that the South African Defence Force in particular was starving Rhodesia of ammunition and weaponry. In fact, a former cabinet minister of Rhodesia, Mr. Jack Musset, he said that South Africa had been strangling Rhodesia.
I tried to maintain good official relations with Rhodesia. And Ian Smith makes mention of it in his book, The Great Betrayal, in which he pointed out how Rhodesia was betrayed by other forces. But I maintained, to a certain extent, good relations with them. I even paid an official visit to Rhodesia. And Smith on occasion came down here. But to say that we starved them, I think it's a bit of an exaggeration.
But did we stop supplying them with weaponry and other supplies, for instance?
You must remember at that stage we were under pressure too, heavy pressure.
On the issue of separate development or apartheid, after the assassination of Dr. Verwoerd in 1966, even the Sunday Times editorialized that the concept of the Bantu homelands was one of the great legacies Dr. Verwoerd has left his country. Did you ever really believe that the country's black people and the international community would accept the idea of black homelands spread around South Africa?
Provided we tried to convince them that they must accept it and cooperate with us in the fields of agriculture and industrial development within those homelands. So I really believed that we could gradually continue making it possible for them to economically advance forward.
Why did it not eventually transpire then?
It was a question that we tried to follow the policy of winning the hearts and minds of people. But on the other hand, the pressure and the total onslaught made it very difficult for them. You must remember, at that stage, terrorism took place in South Africa with the bombs in Pretoria, and terrorists entered across our borders, and they killed people. They even burned tires in Johannesburg streets to block the traffic. And we had to counter that with strong measures.
Further to the violence issue, we quote now from the so-called Mandela document, which was presented to P.W. Botha before their meeting in July 1989.
The organization, the ANC, has no vested interest in violence, but we consider the armed struggle a legitimate form of self-defense against a morally repugnant system of government which will not allow even peaceful forms of protest.
Mr. Botha, a hypothetical question, but it has to be asked. What do you think South Africa would have looked like today had there been black majority rule in the country since 1948 when the National Party came into power, or even since the 1960s, when much of Africa was decolonized?
I think by this time we would have been in the drain already.
Why do you say that?
Because the forces of evil gradually took over in Africa, took over in Mozambique, took over in Angola, took over in Rhodesia, and the pressure against South Africa on the East Front and the West Front. That pressure was continually growing. And the result was the propaganda among the black people, trying to convince them that everything was rosy in the garden for them if they just supported the idea of one man, one vote. That was a miserable situation that we found ourselves in.
Miserable indeed. Mr. Mandela wrote that the National Party and its Western friends regarded majority rule as a disaster to be avoided at all costs. And he then commented,
"Yet majority rule and internal peace are like the two sides of a single coin. And white South Africa simply has to accept that there will never be peace and stability in this country until the principle is fully applied."
Many would say that during those years, black people were regarded as inferior to whites. I mean, even the expression subhuman is used. Do you think whites ever regarded black people in that light?
To a certain extent, it's true. that that propaganda was made. And from certain parts of our media, that was a part of the propaganda. From outside, it was part of the propaganda. From the United Nations anti-South African actions, that was the idea behind driving them. But I never looked at the people in this sense of inferior, because many black people, I repeat, many black people and coloreds cooperated positively with government policies.
But if we didn't regard them as inferior, I'm saying we as whites,
we wouldn't have taken into the industrial development areas if they were inferior.
But we denied them so many things. I mean, they couldn't eat in the same restaurants, we had job reservation, they couldn't vote or anything. I mean, is that not the way you treat a person that's inferior?
You must remember one thing. We did not originate that sense or that part of the so-called apartheid policy. This very policy started in Lord Milner's time, in Cecil Rhodes' time, and in the time of the British governors of the Eastern Province and Natal. So it's a very, very old policy that existed. We didn't invite it.
No, but we were happy to perpetuate it because, I mean, we were actually racists at heart at that stage as well, isn't it?
Yes,
so?
Some of our people were, and some of them are still.
In 1988, Botha spoke on Nazism in the House of Assembly.
Neo-Nazism hides behind many cloaks. South Africa will have to dissociate itself from these sick people and their actions if she wants to get somewhere.
Moving on now, actually, and tying in with us, that famous Rubicon speech of yours in 1985. Speculation was rife at the time that you would announce major changes and even a commitment to the concept of a unitary state.
That's right. Yeah. But that was not true. And the Rubicon, the word Rubicon, was only one word in the whole speech. But suddenly it became the Rubicon speech. That wasn't the case.
So in other words, you didn't feel the time was ripe then for such major changes to be made.
I had in my mind, broadly speaking, to gradually bring in a system of government on the basis of confederation. And I said so. I said so in Parliament. I advocated a system of confederation in South Africa and confederal cooperation in Southern Africa.
Again, looking at that 1989 cabinet meeting, at its conclusion, Mr. de Klerk stated that it would be a wrong deduction to state that cabinet ministers had become soft about the ANC and that they were being led by the nose by anyone wishing to promote the interests of the ANC. Those are the words of Mr. de Klerk. Did he keep that pledge, do you think, or did he indeed turn soft?
I think they weakened. I think they weakened, and I foretold it. I said to them, I feel sorry for you, because the horses you are taking in control are wild horses, and you will find that eventually they will harm you. And I was prophesying the correct thing.
Only about a month earlier in his document, Mr. Mandela called for an ANC government meeting to discuss a negotiated settlement and wrote,
two central issues will have to be addressed at such a meeting. Firstly, the demand for majority rule in a unitary state. Secondly, the concern of white South Africans over this demand, as well as the insistence of whites on structural guarantees that majority rule will not mean domination. Such reconciliation will be achieved only if both parties are willing to compromise.
Some people, they feared a bloodbath, Mr. Botha, after the 1994 election. Did you share those fears?
No, not exactly. South Africa, right through its history, was a country where violence took place from time to time. I didn't look at that stage in the sense that I expected a bloodbath. But violence was a possibility. But we had strong security forces. We had a strong defense force. We had a really well-trained police force.
Did you ever, during your presidency and before, ever think that the ANC would take over the rule of this country? You know, when Mr. Pik Botha mentioned the possibility of a black president, I think a huge number of whites thought, what nonsense is that?
The immediate reaction was that the then leader of the National Party in Transvaal, Mr. de Klerk, and the then Minister of Constitutional Government, Mr. Hunes, approached me and they complained against the actions taken by the Minister of Foreign Affairs. I called the three together, and after having had a proper discussion, Mr. Botha wrote me a letter in which he admitted that he didn't actually advocate party policy. And I stated that in Parliament. Now I hear that I repudiated him. That is not true. What I said was I gave the facts of the two colleagues who complained about his action.
Why was the country then forced into that road of one man, one vote, and that's it?
Yes, that was actually after I left. I withstood it. I said so in Parliament, that I'm not in favor of one man, one vote. But under the confederal system, you could accept the principle of one man, one vote for that community or that special part of the confederation.
Well, then why did Mr. de Klerk and company decide on a one man, one vote election? I mean, is it then simply they didn't want to stay in power through the barrel of a gun or what? What was their thinking?
I had a personal discussion with him on this matter. And it was taped in this very house. And I told him that he became weak as against the forces trying to break South Africa. I looked on the television where he addressed a press conference in Washington. And the previous President Bush, the father of the present President Bush, stood next to him. And there he announced that he would stand for irreversible policy. That very night I looked at television and I said to people sitting with me, there is the beginning of the end.
Do you think it was the beginning of the end, Mr. Botha, or was it simply the end of a new beginning for the country via a new constitution, the 94 elections? Wasn't it actually inevitable, given all the pressures?
No, I think we should have gone on with our positive way of thinking and trying to introduce the European system of government and not the American system.
At two National Party meetings in 1980, P.W. Botha was emphatic about his visions for South Africa.
We must find a solution not only in a constellation of states, but eventually in a form of confederation of independent states, as far as our neighbors are concerned. For as long as I am leader of the National Party, there will not be one man, one vote in Parliament, and there will not be one man, one vote in a federal Parliament. I do not believe that that would be in the interests of the whites, nor do I believe that it would be in the interests of the blacks, for from such a situation, blood and strife in South Africa will surely flow. It did not work anywhere else in Africa. You either got dictatorship, or you got a one-party state, or you got the destruction of the people.
Affirmative action, looking now at more or less the latest issues, and the offshoots such as black economic empowerment, transformation, and so on. Now, they are designed to assist the previously disadvantaged. How do you view these policies?
I think it's a bad form of apartheid.
A bad form?
And it's a miserable form. It drives know-how out of the country. And it drives valuable people to look for jobs in other countries. And it's a pity. Those people should not have left South Africa. They should have stayed here and given the opportunity with their talents to help developing the country, create jobs, and create a strong economy.
Well, what can be done, do you think, then, to uplift the previously disadvantaged black people?
Yes, that is a very important question. I'm looking sometimes, when we drive into George, and I see the young black people coming from the homelands, sitting here in some sort of housing schemes without work. I think a proper reversal of policies should take place. A proper reversal to see what can be done to create work opportunities.
In 1986, Mr. Botha told the House of Assembly,
"We can only get somewhere if the first world economy in this country is allowed to adopt a policy of upliftment towards the third world economy. Secondly, we can only get somewhere if the white leadership is not undermined. And we can only get somewhere if the safety of the whites in South Africa is not undermined."
Pessimists in South Africa and elsewhere, they are warning that we may be heading for a Zimbabwe-type situation. Are you more optimistic?
No. I want to say this. Sometimes I wonder whether the pessimists are not right. Now, what's going to happen to Zimbabwe, I can't say. All I know is that there's a lack of proper development there. They admit it themselves. So it's not out of the question that South Africa could eventually land there. Because there is real corruption in South Africa. And I had a black minister here from one of the homelands a while ago. And he asked me, what do I think of the South African situation? And I said to him, you know, there's only one type of erection where you start from the top to create, and that is a grave. While The best form of development is to start at the bottom. And I still believe we must start at the bottom. Create jobs. Create opportunities. This story of affirmative action should be abolished. This black empowerment should be abolished. It should be abolished as soon as possible. And cooperation should take place.
Corruption, Mr. Botha, among politicians and civil servants. It is so rife today that it verges on the ridiculous. Yet it's often claimed that it was as bad, if not worse, during National Party rule, but that there was a massive cover-up.
No, that's not correct. In the days of a Minister of Finance, such as the late Mr. Tlazi Havenga, he was world-renowned for his capabilities and for his decent way of dealing with the finances of the country. After him, Dr. Dundas became the Minister of Finance. It is true that in any country where you have human government, there from time to time originate corruptive practices. But the question is when you find out where the corruption takes place, whether you are prepared to deal with it.
But did you people try to find out, or was there a cover-up, do you think?
No, we didn't try to cover up. We actually fought and acted against corruption when it became known to us. I can mention a few examples to you, where eventually a cabinet minister landed in jail. Yes.
And after 50 years in politics, Mr. Botha, how wealthy are you?
You're referring to me?
Yes.
Well, all I can tell you is this house where we're sitting here, I bought from a man who lived here with his wife, and I had to take a loan. I had to make a loan at Sambo, the then Sambo, who disappeared since then. And I paid off monthly basis the real amount that I owed them for this house. I've never become wealthy. I've never become a member of the wealthy club.
A question frequently asked, Mr. Botha. Via the TRC hearings and a multitude of other reports, we have heard of murders, torture, and other heinous acts by branches of the security forces during National Party rule. For example, the deeds perpetrated at Vlakplaas. Were you or any of your cabinet ever aware of such cruelties taking place, and if not, why?
Now, let me say this. I speak now with the knowledge of what happened before me. The late Dr. Verwoerd would never have given a leave for people to commit murders and bad actions against South African citizens. The same applies to Foster. Foster was against it. But I differed with him on some occasions. But as a cabinet, even under my prime ministership or presidentship, I would never have granted leave for such actions. But when it became known, the necessary steps were taken. What happened at the Truth Commission, I can't speak for that because they subpoenaed out me to appear before him. I called them a circus. and it's well known that eventually I landed in court because of my attitude not to appear before them. And they found me guilty with the necessary conclusions from their decision. I appealed to the Supreme Court in Cape Town, and I won the case.
Were those security forces thus a kind of law unto themselves, with no control from higher up?
Yes, in certain cases it might have been the position. Look, in a human organization, such as the police force at that stage, you might get individuals who take the law into their own hands. And that is wrong, but that should be dealt with the moment you get notice that something is wrong.
So you people also, obviously not knowing about it, you say we do not accept any responsibility for it.
No, the question of responsibility is something different. You always carry the responsibility, whether your subordinates act in the correct way or not. I, for instance, accepted responsibility in the administration falling under me. So you can't get away from your responsibility as a public figure. Say, for instance, in this case where a cabinet minister was eventually found guilty of corruptive purposes, we accepted the responsibility, but we didn't side with him in the way he dealt with the matters, and we didn't try to protect him. The law went its course.
The rule of Thabo Mbeki and Nelson Mandela, how would you compare them?
It is well known that Mr. Nelson Mandela, at his own request, saw me on different occasions in Cape Town and here in Wilderness. I warned him against policies, dangerous policies for the country. At one stage he was sitting in this very room and he requested me to come back into politics.
In what capacity?
As leader of the National Party.
Oh.
And I declined. I said to him, no, I can't cooperate in that sense because I fundamentally differ the way you are dealing with matters and the way I'm dealing with matters. You know, he declined to renounce violence as a way of dealing with political life. I warned him against communism, although he stated in the court who found him guilty that he was quoted to describe how to be a good communist. I never liked his policies, and he knows it. I never saw him on occasion to warn against terrorism and communism. He never did so. The same applies to the President Mbeki. I never saw him warning against terrorism and communism. So, both of them, in certain aspects, act the same in the same way.
In his document, Nelson Mandela referred to concerns about ANC links with the South African Communist Party and wrote,
I've already pointed out that no self-respecting freedom fighter will allow the government to prescribe who his allies in the freedom struggle should be, and that to obey such instructions would be a betrayal of those who have suffered repression with us for so long. We equally reject the charge that the ANC is dominated by the SACP, and we regard the accusation as part of the smear campaign the government is waging against us.
How do you view your career, the good parts and possibly the parts you regret? And what message do you have for this Rainbow Nation, as it is now called, particularly with regard to its future?
When I look back, I feel happy about the share I had in building up the national body. I thoroughly enjoyed it, to serve under prominent leaders of the past. And after that, I became a senior member of the party. My days as Minister of Defense were some of the most lucky days in my life. And so was the development of our arms industry. I look back with deep appreciation for the opportunities I had to deal with my share of commitment in the sense. I was very much disappointed when I saw that the National Party dwindled away. It brought forward strong leaders in the past. But eventually, it seems to me, disappointment took control over itself.
Did you have any regrets in your life as leader?
Look, I've been in public life for more than 50 years. Over such a period, you have your disappointments, but you also have your very pleasant days. And I would say that looking back, if I have to do again what I've done, I'll repeat it.
And how do you see the future of the country, Mr. Botha? Any message for our Rainbow Nation? What must they do to remain a rainbow?
Look, I don't believe there's such a thing as a Rainbow Nation. I think it's the wrong word. To call it an absurdity, I think would be right. The colors of the rainbow are quite different from the colors in South Africa and in any other country. I don't agree with the term Rainbow Nation. No, we're a country of multicultural minorities. That is what we are, multicultural minorities. And we should build for the future on those principles: economic cooperation, cultural mutual respect, and dedicated service.
Okay, now I'll comment on some things. Also, just to give you an idea of the scale on which I did things in the past. My current African crisis that I started in recent years, that only has about 3,900 articles on it. Whereas my history reviewed is over 24,000 articles. But my original African crisis, the section that I pulled out from 2001 to the end of 2011, is 110,000 articles. It contains stuff that is totally unique. In fact, it is a good thing that I thought ahead even back then. So I made a practice for a long time, which is a practice I still continue, and it's a practice that works, I must tell you. And that is, I would copy entire articles in the past. So I wouldn't just post the source link of the article, I would actually post the entire text of the article. And I have got tens of thousands of articles that exist in my archive where the original websites are gone. There's even lots and lots of mass media stuff from big mass media organizations, especially in South Africa, where they themselves have either changed their links or they've dumped the data out of their databases and they never republished it when they got new websites. And there is tons and tons of stuff that I've got from websites that no longer exist. And virtually every African website that I quote articles from no longer exists. Afrikaans websites and lots of other stuff, it's all gone. It doesn't exist, but I at least have got some copies. And while I was actually starting to browse these things for the first time in more than a decade, I may even have an article that I published a few weeks before 9/11 that might be the only prediction of 9/11 that I can find, but it's very strange. And I will do a separate video on it shortly. It may be the only article that I've ever come across that is an actual prediction for 9/11. But it needs to be explained because it's actually a very strange article. Very strange. And the sources it comes from just adds to the strangeness. And there may be a follow-up article too that also ties back to that one. And if people are truly interested, they could go hunting for a video because it ties back to a video. Okay, so in the Afrikaans section, they talk about the information scandal, which I've already mentioned. Information scandal, much ado about nothing, claiming the whites are all kinds of criminals and getting up to all kinds of shit, when in fact it's really much ado about nothing. And it's a true double standard. The whites of South Africa get whacked for something that's actually not a crime. And maybe they did break some little government rule here and there, but I assure you, in the grander scheme of things, they literally did nothing wrong. Okay, so a critical thing that P.W. Botha talks about at length is the word apartheid. And he's jumping around and he's trying to duck and dive the issue. So he then talks about Dr. Malan. Dr. Malan was the first Prime Minister of South Africa under apartheid. Apartheid came in 1948. It came in the form of a political party called the National Party. The National Party was itself actually originally anti-Semitic. The original National Party actually was very racist. But then some strange things happened and They then started changing their mind, and a whole bunch of other stuff happened, including the assassination of Verwoerd. So the national party that runs apartheid gets hit six ways to Sunday for decades and decades, starting with liberals and Jews and communists, and just carrying on and on right to the end until the whites actually just hand over the country. So they are demonized for the fake crime of apartheid, in the same way that Rhodesia and the Portuguese, etc., are hit for the fake crime of colonialism. Everybody's been colonizing all across the world, but now it's suddenly a crime. So then what PW does is he tries to put a positive spin on it, and he starts to say that, well, apartheid was really about trying to uplift the blacks. And he also then says that among themselves, they also argued about whether they should even use the term apartheid. You see, what happened is they got such a beating and such a hiding in the mass media across the world for decades over this word apartheid that it kind of shell-shocked them. And nowadays they're jumping around over this word apartheid, okay? And they are now trying to duck and dive the whole issue. So now he says that a term he preferred was good neighborliness, that they shouldn't have used the word apartheid, they should have used the word good neighborly. In other words, we're going to be good neighbors to our black neighbors. He also talks again about the very important concept that South Africa is a nation of minorities. That if you actually look at South Africa, it's not just whites and blacks. The blacks themselves are separate tribes. These tribes talk different languages. So you mustn't equate the blacks of South Africa with the blacks of America, where all of them speak English and they all are one group. In Africa, it's more like Europe, and the blacks talk different languages and they've got different cultures. So with the blacks, it's more like the French, the Germans, the Italians. They had their own territory, they had their own language, etc. So P.W. Botha refers to South Africa as a nation of minorities, and he had his own particular view that the way to make South Africa work was through a confederation like the Swiss, like the Belgians. So that's where this good neighborliness term comes into the thing. As for me, I personally preferred the term separate development. That was the term they used a lot when I was younger, and I loved that term. I thought that term explained it dead on. Because what they then started doing was they started giving blacks chunks of territory, saying, this is your homeland, you rule it, you do your own thing. So that's the context. But P.W. Botha then jumps around, and other Boers have also said a similar thing to what he says, where they say, well, you know, we didn't start apartheid. The British started apartheid. And Lord Milner and Cecil John Rhodes, they did apartheid. We didn't have apartheid. But that is also a bit of a disingenuous defense, that. Because in the Boer republics, for example, when the Boers were living in the Boer republics, blacks couldn't vote there. So there was apartheid in the Boer republics. When the Boers were free and before the British came, the Boers didn't have blacks voting in their republics. You see, the bottom line with all the whites, the Rhodesians, the Boers, the South Africans, whether they are English-speaking or Afrikaans-speaking, is at the end of the day, all these whites were racist and they didn't want blacks ruling them and they didn't want blacks to have the freaking vote. okay? And they never even considered these things feasible. They looked down on the blacks to such a degree, they regarded them as total morons, and they had no intention whatsoever of allowing them to ever have a vote. And that is how the whites were for hundreds of years. And it is only now after World War II that suddenly now this is an issue. And then you have the rise of communism and liberalism and all this other stuff. Only then does it become a problem. But for the prior 300 years, whether it was Boers living by themselves or Boers living under the British, the system is racist. Though, to add to it, another proof of the racism of the Boers is that even under the British system, which they say was segregation, you will find that the Boers left the Cape Colony because they regarded the British as too liberal. And there were, in fact, some whites who did marry black women. So the Boers leaving the Cape, a large part of the reason they left the Cape, which was British rule, was because the British were too liberal and the British were applying the same laws to them as to the blacks. And they wanted to go and live in their own country, rule themselves, and they were going to be more racist. But you find lots of these Boers trying to now duck and dive and blame it on the British and so forth. The fact is all whites, including the British, including every single colony in Africa, by every single European nation, everybody was racist. But now you got whites jumping around trying to pretend it wasn't so. The Rhodesians are even worse. But that is the explanation he gives. He then says, well, you know, Cecil Rhodes was doing it, etc. And also, what is apartheid? Apartheid is basically segregation. It is, in a nutshell, segregation, but it goes a bit further in that it's going to create territories. And under apartheid, most of South Africa is regarded as a whites-only country, and the non-whites are regarded as second-rate citizens. So that is what apartheid was. And then the whole issue about starting the homelands, it may have been initiated by Verwoerd because of the heat he was taking internationally. The other thing in this discussion about the total onslaught is that the total onslaught is not just the communists. He then says it includes selected Western nations. There are Western nations that are also part of this onslaught, but he never mentions their names. Some of these could be like Sweden, for example, and all other liberal ones in Europe, but there may have been others specifically. I'm not sure what their definition was of who the other specific enemies were. He talks about the Broederbond. I've discussed the Broederbond before. This was the organization, the secret organization that took control of South Africa. It allowed the whites to survive, or the Boers to survive, the Boer War, and to come back and seize control of the country. Because South Africa, after the Boer War, became very liberal, and it was done by people who were very much in line, Afrikaans speakers who were very much in line with the British. So when the whites got their chance, they made South Africa racist. That's what they did in 1948, and that is the history of apartheid. And now everyone's ducking and diving about it. The Broederbond was the organization that created all the things that they needed. It created the political party. It created the funding mechanisms. It created the newspapers. It was a very sophisticated idea. And at the end of its existence, you'll see everybody's ducking and diving and jumping away from it, and nobody is a part of it, etc. But it was a white man's club. It was whites only. I think it was white men only, exclusively, working together as a secret brotherhood. And at its peak, it had 10,000 members. P.W. Botha was a member of it for a period of time, but there were tons of others who were members of it too. He talks proudly of the SADF, the South African Defence Force, the military of South Africa in the time of apartheid. He was the Minister of Defence, I think, for 14 years. He played a very critical role in the creation of this massive military machine. And he proudly boasts that it was the strongest army in Africa. I would go on to say it was the strongest army in Africa, and it was hardly ever used to even a fraction of its true capability. This machine was awesome, and it probably hardly even did 10% of what it was capable of. So one thing I want to make clear to all of you is the notion that, oh, the whites were on their back foot, the whites were losing, the blacks were beating them, the whites had to surrender because the blacks were smashing them. Total bullshit. The whites were totally and utterly militarily dominant right to the end. Right to the end. There are specific aspects of this that I want to return to. The whites were absolutely dominant right to the end. They had a massive army, and it was freaking good. Excellent equipment, totally professional, absolute killer army. And its high point of its time was fighting the Russians and Cubans directly. But that was only a fraction of what it was capable of. It was capable of amazing things. P.W. Botha mentions a man called Dr. Triernicht, and he tells a Christian story there. Dr. Triernicht was a preacher. Dr. Triernicht was a man who in the 1980s created a Conservative Party of South Africa, and he started fighting against the National Party, which is what P.W. Botha was in charge of. In other words, the National Party under pressure was starting to become too liberal and too open. The term used here is reform. Okay? P.W. Botha did some reforms. Not many, but he did some. And then F.W. de Klerk came along and just freaking took reform and turned it into total surrender. But P.W. Botha did some reform while retaining control of South Africa. He never gave away the country. But there were white right-wingers who said, no, this is wrong. Triernicht was one of them. So Triernicht headed the Conservative Party, and he said that the National Party is getting too liberal. Then you also had Eugene Terblanche of the AWB. He was totally against it. And you have the greatest political party, the one I really appreciate nowadays, and that political party was one that I didn't really appreciate at the time. But nowadays, now that I'm older and I've met many people who are associated with it, it was the greatest political party and everybody ignored it. It was called the HNP, the Herstichte Nationale Partei. They were basically the Nazis of South Africa, the HNP. The HNP was the original version of the National Party, and they were total racists. They were basically the Nazi Party of South Africa. I'm not joking with you. They understood Hitler, they understood Jews, they understood all that stuff. And everybody has forgotten about them, and at the time everybody ignored them. But anyway, he goes on to say that this Andries Triernicht was a conservative, and I personally at the time that I lived here, when Andries Trionicht started this conservative party, I supported it because I agreed with any kind of improved resistance to this business of becoming more liberal. So I quite liked Trionicht, and somewhere in my archives I've got a letter that I wrote to him and a reply that I got from him. I will keep looking for it. I do have the reply that I got from Andries Trionicht. Anyway, he and Andries Trionicht, and this is quite funny, he and Andries Trionicht were arguing about apartheid. And at a point, he then told Andries Trionicht that in the Bible, Moses had a mixed marriage, that Moses had a mixed race marriage. And Trionicht agreed with him, yeah, there was a mixed race marriage in the Bible. So the bummer here is that they are now caught out by the Bible. They are busy trying to practice racism and look after their own people, while the Bible is their moral code. And then P.W. Botha himself points out that in the Bible, it does have this particular issue. So that is that is one of the things that comes up. P.W. Botha goes into quite a discussion about the best system for South Africa, and as I've mentioned to you, he believes in the confederal system. He basically believes in a system like the people in Switzerland have, and I think the whites in Belgium also have it. And he actually talks at length in the Afrikaans section about this in various places, where he talks about professors and other academics that he ordered, he sent them to Europe to go and study various systems in Europe to see what can be learned from Europe for South Africa. And this is a wonderful thing in that you will find under apartheid, the whites of South Africa, the National Party, dealt a lot with Europe, and they had access to European nations, and they'd go to various European countries that were friendly to them, and they would talk to them, and they'd get data. And it was a wonderful piece of cooperation with the Europeans. There's a lot of examples of European cooperation with South Africa, especially the more southern European nations. Now, a interesting discussion that he gets into, and it's actually a discussion that was even mentioned in Rhodesia, Ian Smith even spoke about this in Rhodesia, was the issue of which form of one man, one vote is the best form for Southern Africa. And you might think that democracy is democracy, but actually it isn't. And he starts talking about the Westminster system. The Rhodesians also spoke about this. The Westminster system is the system they use in Britain. Now, the real issue that bothered the whites in such a system where you are going to have less of the vote and be a minority is what P.W. Botha described here. He said the Westminster system is a winner-takes-all system. So it seems to me if you get like 51% or so of the vote, that then you have like total power. Whereas when the whites are looking at losing power and operating as a minority in the future, they want something where they've still got some kind of veto and some way of not just being overrun. And so, just like the Rhodesians, he says the Westminster system, not good for South Africa. That will not work for us. Now, in his confederal system, it's very much like the system in America in the South. In his confederal system, he talks about South Africa being a confederation of states. So this in American terms is almost like states' rights, where these states have got a lot of power. So there's not that centralized power like you have in America now. This is exactly the same as the South, the American South. So he foresaw a system for South Africa where the whites and blacks, all the races, have their own pieces of territory and they function as a confederation. And he said that he wanted to expand this to operate in all of Southern Africa so that South Africa and the others also have a confederal system at a higher level, something like that. He was a huge believer in a confederal system. And when he spoke to me, he told me that the best systems, I think, were in Switzerland and Belgium. And they studied it and they liked it. And they said that those systems could work in Africa. And that is where he wanted to go. But then he goes on to say that the current system we have is almost an American system. He doesn't know how this came about. He thinks this is the traitor F.W. de Klerk going and chatting to George Bush Sr. because he spoke about F.W. de Klerk appearing on TV next to George Bush Sr. and stating in public that this process, this political process in South Africa is irreversible. So the Americans must have put some kind of pressure on the weakling de Klerk to make him say that, that he's not going to suddenly pull the plug on the blacks. He's going to carry on endlessly until he hands over power. So there's other stuff going on here in the time of F.W. de Klerk. I repeat, there are things there that truly are probably hidden away in government archives. Probably for 75 years. Classified. He also talks about F.W. de Klerk and the pressure of sanctions. So it seems to me that the thing that may have been the heaviest thing that really hurt the white leaders in the end, and it affected him and it affected de Klerk, was that the Western world was going to put sanctions on South Africa. Now, there were partial sanctions and bits and pieces of sanctions, like the British already had stopped selling weapons to South Africa in the 1960s. So armaments sanctions already existed. And there were possibly other lighter forms of sanctions. But the blacks and the communists and the liberals were pushing for like all-out sanctions, like Rhodesia. And I think that sanctions, if I listen to P.W. Botha, it looks like sanctions, the threat of sanctions, was the real thing that made the whites cave. It wasn't the war, it wasn't the fighting of the blacks, it was the threat from the West of sanctions. Most likely America and Britain leading the charge, that is the real reason the whites called it a day. He also talks about the ANC, the current ruling party of our one-party state. We live in a one-party state here in South Africa, run by the ANC. Bunch of commies, and the liberals describe it, oh no, it's a democracy. No, it's actually a one-party state. But anyway, the ANC is the ruling party, and P.W. Botha actually unwittingly says something really interesting. He says that no white leader ever spoke to or negotiated with the ANC. Not even Jan Smuts, who was the liberal before apartheid. Not even D.F. Malan, the first leader under apartheid. So that will show you the contempt and the power of the whites in the past, that they could just ignore this black organization and they didn't even talk to them. They didn't even waste their time on them. But this organization, backed by communists and money, was to become their biggest problem. P.W. Botha also says that at a point he toured Europe. He went specifically to Britain, Germany, Italy, and Belgium when he was the president of South Africa to discuss with them his actual views on the situation. And he did this in the 1980s. He also spoke to other non-whites, like the coloureds and the Indians, and he played a role in allowing the coloureds and the Indians to first start voting. They kind of set up a place where the coloureds and Indians could vote a bit. This was under the latter stages of apartheid. I think it's called the tricameral system. It's not something that I have bothered looking at much. But the process was like that. So when the whites were under pressure, then they started giving the coloureds and the Indians the vote. The blacks were last on the list. Resisting black rule was always the highest priority. He goes on to say that the ANC was and remains communist to this day. He also discusses Nelson Mandela and that Nelson Mandela came and visited him and that Nelson Mandela even asked him to come back into politics and even asked him to come back and lead the National Party. So this is quite a kick in the teeth for the coward and the traitor F.W. de Klerk. It's quite a kick in the teeth that Mandela doesn't go to F.W. de Klerk and ask him to come back into politics. Mandela comes back to P.W. Botha and asks him to enter politics. I suspect, it is my guess, that Mandela was under some kind of pressure and that Mandela probably had some kind of resistance from the whites and needed more cooperation from the whites, and that he's trying to drag P.W. Botha in because P.W. Botha most likely has got credibility. If he says yes, then others will agree. But he did say that Mandela actually came to him twice. When I was at his house, he showed me his guest book. He had a guest book, and everybody who visits him signs the guest book. He showed me Nelson Mandela's signature in his guest book. So these things happened, okay? Anyway, he goes on to say that he told Mandela that he's not going to return to politics, that he disagrees with Mandela. In a nutshell, he's basically saying to Mandela, I disagree with you and your way of working and thinking. I therefore will not cooperate with you. In a nutshell, that's what it boils down to. He was asked, you know, well, at least a bloodbath was avoided in South Africa at the end of white rule. So P.W. Botha says, yes, that is true, but there were other prices that were paid. There were other negatives that had to be swallowed. And he talked about things like farm murders and also that the farmers' land is up for grabs. At a point, they talk about transformation. This is one of the many word games that is played here in South Africa by the black commies and the liberals and so forth. They talk about transformation. One of these sort of liberal, commie, sneaky words. And so P.W. Botha says, what does that mean? You know, what's that word? What does it mean? Well, here's our sneaky enemy. And our sneaky enemy is sneaking all kinds of things under our noses all the time. And the blacks and liberals are basically telling us they're going to change society. But anyway, in the interview, he says, what does it mean? He is asked, what advice can he give to the youth who have left the country? He points out that lots of youngsters have left the country, including members of his own family. His own advice is that they should gain knowledge and come back to South Africa and fight for a new dispensation in the future. He also discusses again Afrikaner and Taal, Taal being language and culture. He comes out very aggressively against any form of gun control. And he says that we should have weapons and the commando system. Now, the commando system was the system that the farmers used to protect themselves. The farmers organized themselves into units known as commandos. He said that the commando system, which, by the way, the blacks had shut down, that one black that I detest, President Mbeki, he was the bastard who shut down the commando system. Anyway, P.W. Botha said we must be allowed to own guns and we must be allowed to reinstate the entire commando system so that the farmers can protect each other. And he also says that the Boers have been big into shooting all through their existence and that sports shooting should also be allowed. He also went on to tell a little bit more about his own family. It turns out his mother was actually a big-time Christian missionary. His mother even traveled to other black countries, mostly to countries nearby like Botswana and Zambia, but even far up into Africa. In her entire life, she spent all her time teaching and helping these blacks and doing Christian missionary work. In other words, teaching them about the Bible, teaching them how to help themselves, teaching them all these things. And he says that she literally dropped dead while doing this kind of work. She was so determined to do it. He goes on to tell a whole story about how his own father helped a black, that at one point in time in South Africa, you were not allowed to use gold as money. And his father told a particular black who worked for him, any gold that you've been accumulating, you must bring it. I will take you to the bank and we will change it for money. And then you've got money that you can use. And how this old black guy had saved away 6,000 gold pounds in his hut, and they went and they changed it and gave him currency and so forth. So, showing all this stuff of how they helped the blacks, this stuff is totally true. This is how whites were under colonialism and apartheid. The whites in Rhodesia were the same. If we see that the blacks have got a problem or something's happening and the blacks don't understand it, we say to them, okay, you do this and this and I'll show you how and we'll help you and quickly sort it out. The whites were not as nasty and mean-spirited and malicious as our enemies like to portray. There are many, many things that all whites did. There were times when blacks were pissing the whites off and whites were really angry with them, but there are also vast, vast numbers of times when whites did things for blacks that the blacks didn't deserve. Again, proof that he's a Boer, he says that his father fought right through the entire Boer War from the beginning to the end, and that during the Boer War, the British threw his mother into a concentration camp. And this is where 32,000 women and children died. So his mother was in a British concentration camp. He is asked about a thing called the TRC. The TRC is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This is another bunch of bunk they did right at the end of apartheid. This is basically South Africa's version of the Nuremberg trials, basically. P.W. Botha refused to go to the TRC. He said openly that it's a circus. I think they actually lodged a case against him for not going. They found him guilty. Then he went to the Supreme Court and won the case there, and he basically was able to get away from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, because they were hauling all these previous white leaders there, looking and hunting for crimes and things that they committed. It's a whole load of bunk. I don't waste much time with the TRC. The TRC ended up becoming a thing where it didn't have to do about the truth. They would find some truth, and if the truth was something that could expose the whites, then they'd whack the whites with it. But if some of the truth was going to make the blacks look bad, then everybody covered it up. A load of bunk. Waste of time. So then it comes back to the TRC. He says that at a point, I think he compiled something like a 2,000-page document for the TRC. So this may contain perhaps other stuff, maybe even stuff the ANC did, I don't know. But he compiled a 2,000-page document and gave it to the TRC. And whether they ignored it, I don't know. It is very possible. Anyway, he is asked again, what did the National Party do? Did it use violence against its enemies? We're back to that hypocritical junk where, you know, the whites get beaten over this, but what the blacks do doesn't get mentioned, etc. So he says that neither he nor any of the other leaders would ever have given orders to people to torture and kill. So this has to do with places like Vlak Plaas and other people in the military and in intelligence who did some nasty things to the blacks. As for me, I just shrug my shoulders. I just say what's good for the goose is good for the gander. The blacks were torturing, the blacks were killing. If the blacks could torture, then we can torture too. I don't see why the whites should be held up to one set of standards while the blacks are not. The blacks did many, many worse things than the whites, and here the whites are ducking and diving about why they apparently, you know, didn't do this. It is very sad that this is how it ends up, but when you're the loser, then the winners get to control your future. And that, I'm afraid, is where the whites ended up. So he then says, some people did commit crimes, as in all societies. So it's not lots of people committed crimes, a few committed crimes, and that's it. He does say that as a leader, even if he didn't give the order, he is responsible. So at least he is man enough to say that much. Whatever his shortcomings might be, he's still a huge lot better than the weak, pathetic scumbag F.W. de Klerk. Finally, he's asked what advice to give to the Rainbow Nation. Rainbow Nation is a term for South Africa that just popped up from liberal sources. I myself have wondered if it's got a Jewish origin, personally. But anyway, he mocks the Rainbow Nation. He says there's no such concept. And then he goes into a detailed discussion about the academics he sent to Europe and the whole thing about confederations. And he says that a European parliamentary system is much better than the Westminster system and better than the American system. And that's pretty much the main set of points out of the Afrikaans stuff. All the other stuff that he spoke about is more minor. These were the most important things. So, that's where we will end this video. Those people who maybe can speak Dutch or are Afrikaans and can understand Afrikaans, what follows is the Afrikaans version. Listen to it. It's much more lively. I've tried to pull out the main pieces for the English speakers so that they at least get some idea of what was said in there. So that is the last statement of President P.W. Botha of South Africa. This was in January 2006, and 10 months later he was dead. So it's the last words of a man who had a lot of power. And I think he was the president of South Africa for about 10 years. And we will discuss him more when I go through my other notes. So here's the Afrikaans interview.
Hierdie aandenkings wat voormalige staatspresident P.W. Botha so 2 maande voor sy 90ste verjaarsdag op 12 Januarie 2006 aan my gewys het, is vir hom van die kosbaarste in sy versameling. Tydens sy half eeuw in die politiek het Pieter Willem Botha inderdaad diep voetspore in Suid-Afrika se hoogs omstrede geskiedenis gelaat, totdat hy as staatspresident bedank, na stormachtige en bitter vergadering met sy kabinet op 15 Augustus 1989. 'n Sameloop van omstandighede het Mark Williams van Tutuka Productions laat besluit om my te vra om by P.W. Botha te hoor of hy 'n TV-onderhoud sou toestaan, iets wat hy vir 10 jaar geweier het om te doen. Tutuka wou 'n lang TV-onderhoud voer, eintlik 2, een in Engels en een in Afrikaans, wat as 'n erflating beskou kon word. Nie net was meneer Botha vinnig op pad 90 toe, maar die SABC het laat weet dat hulle gepaste onderhoude van 'n biografiese aard wil hê. PW het ingestem. Die onderhoude is gedoen en aan die SABC besorg. Senior lede van die SABC het die Engelse onderhoud met enthousiasme aanvaar en voorgestel dat dit op meneer Botha se 90ste verjaarsdag uitgesaai word. Maar daarna het iets gebeur. En skielik was die onderhoud glad nie meer aanvaarbaar nie. Ten spyte van die onderhoude se klaarblyklike historiese belang, was daar ook geen ander TV-kanaal wat bereid was om hierdie kontensieuse onderhoude uit te saai nie. Aanvanklik het die SABC ons selfs versoek om uit te vind wat meneer Botha se gunsteling lied is, sodat dit gedurende die TV-program op sy verjaarsdag gebruik kon word. Vandag woon meneer P.W. Botha in die wildernis en so kom hy 'n belofte na wat hy gemaak het vir die mense in die George Kies-afdeling, naamlik dat hy daar sou aftree. Daar is ook hoekom hy sy huis die Anker genoem het, om aan te dui dat dit daar is waar hy sy anker neergelaat het na aftrede en hier sal hy bly. Alhoewel daar sekuriteitswagte is, leef die Bothas in relatiewe beskeie, gerieflike omstandighede, in 'n huis wat beskryf kan word as redelik ruim en lekker gemaklik. Sy vrou Barbara is klaarblyklik 'n toegewyde en energieke lewensmaat. Sy het geen probleem om haar man op te som nie.
Peter is a complete man. He's the most balanced, the strongest man. I have ever met in my life.
And a loving
person. Yes.
not a herd crocodile.
Not a herd crocodile.
Ons het PW gevra oor die oorsprong van daardie bynaam wat hy net nie kan afskud nie. Die groot krokodil.
Ek het nie vaste benul nie, is miskien mense wat my bynaam wil gee of etiket wil gee. Ek het wel 'n bynaam en dit is die van PW, PW.
Ja.
Dit het ontstaan aan die universiteit waar my Engelse professor altyd van PW gepraat het.
Ja, maar u voel u het geen affiniteit met 'n groot krokodil nie?
Nee, inteendeel, ek is bang vir 'n krokodil.
Gebore op 12 Januarie 1916 op die plaas Telegraaf in die distrik Paulroo, in die destydse Oranje Vrystaat, het die jong Botha glad nie geweet dat hy bestem was om sy land tydens van Suid-Afrika se moeilikste en uitdagendste jare te lei nie. En dat dit sy bestemming was om 'n leier met 'n uiters hoë profiel te word nie. P.W. Botha was hardwerkend en ambisieus. En op 19-jarige ouderdom was hy al so meegevoer deur die politiek dat hy sy studierigting verander het, sodat hy hom deeglik vir 'n politieke loopbaan kon voorberei. Ondersteuners van P.W. Botha sien 'n grootsheid in die man en bewonder sy sterk leierskapstyl. Sy kritici beskou hom as 'n hardvochtige en hardkoppige leier wat daarop uit was om wit oorheersing in Suid-Afrika te verskans. Ek kry nou die geleentheid om self te oordeel. Die onderhoud met P.W. Botha op 4 November 2005. Meneer Botha, hoe gaan dit deesdae met u?
Ek vra die vraag omdat dit nie 16 jaar gelede aan u gevra is deur lede van u kabinet nie.
Hulle het destyds besluit dat u na 'n ligte beroerte tuig moes neerlê
en by 'n vergadering op 14 Augustus 1989 is voorgestel dat u moes aftree en dit het toe so gebeur.
Dit gaan redelik goed met my. My gesondheid is nie sleg nie, maar goed. Die 14 jaar gelede waarna u verwys het, is natuurlijk die laatste kabinetsvergadering wat daar was, voordat ek bedank het. Maar ek het by daardie geleentheid aan die destijdse collega's reguit gesê dat ek is gezond en meer gezond as hulle. Sedertdien het ek nou hier kom woon. Maar u weet, daai sogenaamde beroerte, wat daar die ligte beroerte, het eers plaasgevind, het al plaasgevind volgens die destijdse inligting in januari van daardie jaar. So die kabinetsvergadering het in augustus plaasgevind. Toen moes ek daarom nou al geleid aan die beroerte. Maar wat ek gedoen het, ek het 'n welbekende persoon in Pretoria, Dr. Meiburg, hierheen laat kom. Hy was die man wat aan die hoof gestaan het van die medische instituut. En ek het hom gevra om my hier te ontmoet, in die wildernis waar ek vir 'n paar dae kom rus het. Hy het gekom, met instrumente en al. En hy het my kom ondersoek, vir 2 dae lang. En toe het hy vir my gesê, jy is gezond, gaan terug naar jou werk toe. Daar was verskil van mening, of dit beroerte is of nie. Maar het lyk vir my, daar die verskil van mening het nie duidelikheid oor die saak gebring nie.
Maar hoe voel u vandag, as u terugdink aan daardie stormagtige gebeure? Voel u dat u kabinetslede opreg was met hulle bekommernisse, of was daar miskien sinistere bybedoelings?
Terugdink aan daardie gebeure, dan sou ek sê, by sommige was daar sinistere bybedoelings. Andere het hulle laat meer sleur. Om sogenaamd leierskap te volg wat hulle op een ander pad sou lei. As ek nou terugdink, dan verbaas dit my dat sommige van hulle het heeltemal van die toneel verdwyn. Daar is van hulle wat my hier besoek het, sedert ek hier woon, en hulle het heel vriendelik kom groet, soos onlangs nog weer. Maar andere het nie hier opgedaag nie, en nooit weer gekom nie. Hulle wil my blijkbaar nie sien nie.
Wie sou u sê was die aanvoerder van die pogings om van u ontslae te raak?
Ek het oor 'n tydperk, voor daardie gebeure in januari, het ek opgemerk dat daar knoeiery is onder sommige persone. En een van my collega's het na my toe gekom en hy het bedank as lid van die kabinet en hy het gesê hy kan die knoeierij nie verder duld nie. Hy het geloop en hy is vandag nog buiten die politiek, hy woon in die Boland.
Wat se knoeierij?
Excuse?
Wat se knoeierij was dit?
Hy het gesê, hy was minister van constitutionele ontwikkeling en hy het gesê dat hy kan niks doen wat vertrouwelijk bly nie, en alles wat hy probeer doen, word geopponeer, en dan word daar stappen geneem, wat het vir hom onmoontlik maak om beleid uit te voer. Toe het hy geloop.
Meneer Botha, die inlichtingsskandaal, as u terugdink aan daardie gebeurtenis, is daar iemand spesifiek wat die blaam moet dra, en voel u dat die skandaal uiteindelik behoorlik en regverdig beredder en opgelos was?
Die destijdse inlichtingsskandaal is degelijk onderzoek door die rechter Erasmus Commissie, wat nog met die medewete van meneer Foster, wat destijds president was, aangestel is. En ook daarna is die Erasmus Commissie se verslag na een parlementaire gekose komitee verwijs om degelijk te onderzoek. Na die verslag van daar die Erasmus Commissie en die parlementaire komitee is het my eerlijke mening dat wijle Dr. Connie Muller het om laat mislei, onwetend misschien, en hy het een duur prijs daarvoor betaal.
Hoe het die politieke sienings van die van meneer John Foster verskil? Daar is menings dat die leierskap oorname een soort van liberale staatsgreep was, waardoor die liberale syde die verkrampte noorde wou teewerk en die mag oorneem.
Ek dink nie dis een korrekte stelling wat mense maak nie. Meneer Foster en ek was in ons jeug intieme vriende. Ons het verskille gehad in ons siening van die lewe, maar hy was behoudend. Nie uiters conservatief nie, maar behoudend. En ek was behoudend. Ek was en is nog altijd een christelike nationalist. Verskille tussen meneer Foster en my het ontstaan jare nadat ek in sy kabinet gedien het. Die verskille het ontstaan oor twee aangeleendhede. Die sy gesindhede teenoor die destijdse bureau van inlichting onder generaal Hendrik van den Berg. Daarmee het ek glad nie saamgestem nie.
Hoekom nie?
Ek het gedink dat die bureau mislei allemaal en doen kwaad. En ek het ook vir hulle regheid gesê. U weet, weile generaal van den Berg het gedreig om my hof toe te neem, maar hy het my nie toe die geneem nie. Hy het een brief moest skrywe aan my, waar hy om verskoning gevraagd. En hy het in die teenwoordigheid van meneer Foster vir my om verskoning gevra. Maar meneer Foster het onnodiglik die bureau beskerm. Dit was een groot verskil.
En die ander rede wat hy genoem het?
Die ander rede was, ek het nie met hom saamgestem wat sy aandeel in die sogenaamde inlichtingsskandaal onderzoek was nie. Hy het een verklaring gemaakt wat hom in die moeilikheid beland het. En ek het met hom daarover verskil. Hy het een verklaring gemaakt waarin hy beweer het dat hy vir Dr. Mulder gewaarsku het. En dit het hom in die moeilikheid laat beland by die Erasmus Commissie. Die ander verskil wat ek met hom gehad het, is hy het in sy politieke siening, was hy meer ingestel op Afrika as geheel. Hy het ook dan reise onderneem selfs na Europa om sy Afrika beleid te verdedig. Ek het meer bepaald die standpunt ingeneem dat ons moet concentreer met een confederale benadering vir Suider-Afrika.
Beskou jy self as 'n liberale denker en doener?
Het is moeilik om te sê of ek nou 'n liberale denker was. Miskien 'n anders denkende persoon wat Afrika betref.
Meneer Botha, hoe het u eintlik die beleid van apartheid, later bekend as afsonderlike ontwikkeling, beskou? Het u werklik geglo dat die idee van onafhanklike swart state prakties uitvoerbaar was en dat die swart meerderheid en die internasionale gemeenskap sulke state sou aanvaar?
Ek was destijds bewus van die moeilikheid wat die woord apartheid veroorsaak het. Dit is een Afrikaanse woord gewees, en nou nog, en mense het nie verstaan wat dit beteken nie. Vooral die in die buitenland nie. Met die gevolg dat daarop is groot agitasies gebou teen Suid-Afrika. Laat my daarby sê, dat ek het na weile dokter Verwoerd en weile dokter Dundas gegaan, en vir hulle gesê, dat ek dink die woord apartheid is verkeerd, om gebruik te word vir ons beleid. Ons moet eerder ander woorde gebruik. Hulle het vir my gevra, wat stel ek voor? En toe het ek gesê, dit moet wees goeie buurskap. Ek het daarna het ek konsekwent die woorde goeie buurskap gebruik.
Maar apartheid het daarom baie ander dinge behels. Ek meen, het was aparte dit en aparte dat en aparte dat. En ek meen, het jy ooit gedink dat dit aanvaarbaar sou wees in 'n wêreld wat na die sogenaamde melting pot toe gemik het?
Ek het getwyfel of het aanvaarbaar sou wees. Want ek was bewus daarvan dat daar groot agitasies in die buitenland is daarteen, dat het een oorzaak is vir sancties teen ons, een van die oorzake. En wat interessant is, dat die aand toe weile dokter D.F. Malang eerste minister geword het in 1948, het hy dit nogal nodig gevind om oor die woord apartheid te praat en te sê, dit is nie die spook wat mense het gewoonlik daaraan heg nie. Dit is eerder een poging om ander mense na eie aard op te hef en hulle in staat te stel om hulle self uit te lewe. Ek het daaraan geglo dat as jy dit billik kon uitleef. Maar daar was mense wat onder die dekmantel van apartheid foute gemaak het. Bewustelik en somtijds onbewustelik. En hulle het foute gemaak waar ons vandag nog lê.
Meneer Botha, baie boeke is al geskryf oor die Afrikaner en sy geskiedenis. Maar ek wil tog u mening hoor oor 'n paar sake wat kritici kwel. Vroeg in die geskiedenis, al het Afrikaners gedink, hulle moet die land regeer, al was hulle in die minderheid. Vanwaar die persepsie en was dit regverdig na u mening?
Daar is baie boeke geskryf oor die Afrikaner, ja. Ek gaan met uw verlof voor uw quotatie lees, oor wat een groot schrijver oor die Afrikaner gesê het, namelijk Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, die welbekende schrijver van die Sherlock Holmes boeken. En nee, ek beskou, as ek nou self moet oordeel, die Afrikaner het sy ontstaan gehad toe selfs een man soos Bidolt, die destijdse bewoner van die plaas Libertas in die Boland, onder Willem Adriaan van der Stel, gesê het, ek is een Afrikaner. Daar het ontstaan. Daarna, onder die Hollandse bewind in Suid-Afrika, die Hollands-Indiese bewind, is die Republiek van Swellendam gestig, omdat die Afrikaner een vryheidsdrang gehad het, selfs teen die Hollandse bewind. Daarna is die Republiek van Graafrenet gestig. En daarna het die Vrystaatse Republiek tot stand gekom. Nadat Pieter Retief een manifest uitgevaardig het. En dit is een welbekende, interessante manifest daardie. Waarin hy sê, dat ons haat nie ander mense nie. Ons soek vryheid. Maar as ons aangeval word, sal ons onsself verdedig. Ek dink die geskiedenis van die republieke van Swellendam en Graafrenet en die manifest van Pieter Retief en die Oranje Vrystaatse Republiek, die loonstraf, die beskuldiging dat die Afrikaner graag domineer. Ek dink ons is basis een vryheidslievende volk, met foute, menslike foute, maar dit was die groot drang was vryheid. Ek lees graag vir u een paragraaf uit uit die geskrywe van Arthur Conan Doyle oor die Afrikaner.
Ja,
take a community of Dutchmen of the type of those who defended themselves for 50 years against all the power of Spain at a time when Spain was the greatest power in the world. Intermix with them a strain of those inflexible French Huguenots who gave up home and fortune and left their country forever at the time of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. The product must obviously be one of the most rugged, virile, unconquerable races ever seen upon earth. Take this formidable people and train them for 7 generations in constant warfare against savage men and ferocious beasts, in circumstances under which no weakling would survive. Place them so that they acquire exceptional skill with weapons and in horsemanship. Give them a country which is eminently suited to the huntsman, the marksman and the rider. Then finally put a finer temper upon their military qualities by an Old Testament religion and an ardent and consuming patriotism. Combine all these qualities and all these impulses in one individual, and you have the modern Boer, the most formidable antagonist who ever crossed the path of Imperial Britain. Baie interessant.
Die sogenaamde swart gevaar het vir baie jare vrees by blanke Suid-Afrikaners aangevuur. Waar het hierdie uitdrukking ontstaan, meneer Botha? En is dit 'n vrees wat die nasionale party uitgebuit het om die mag te behou?
Die stryd oor die sogenaamde swart gevaar het al bestaan in die tyd van Rhodes en Milner. En hulle het stappe geneem om te verhoed dat swart mense in 'n dominerende posisie kom. Die term swart gevaar het polities, kundig, bekend geword in 1928, dit was voor my tyd. En daar het 'n groep mense met die, in 'n verkiesing van 1928, die term swart gevaar gebruik. Daardie term het met die tyd verdwyn en ander uitdrukkings is gesoek, soos parallelle ontwikkeling, afsonderlike ontwikkeling, apartheid en uiteindelik goeie buurskap met grenslyne.
Die Broederbond, hoe belangrik was hierdie geheime organisasie vir die Afrikaner en wat 'n rol het dit uiteindelik gespeel in die land?
Wat die Broederbond betref, laat my dit sê. Daar is 'n boek geskrywe deur professor Pelser. Ek weet nie of hy nog leef nie, maar hy het in Pretoria Universiteit, was hy docent. Hy het 'n boek geskryf, Die Broederbond. Baie interessante boek oor hoe die Broederbond tot stand gekom het en wat het doel. En hy het dit so beskryf dat die Broederbond is een culturele Afrikaner organisatie van protestants gesinde mense wat pogings aanwend om die Afrikaner op ekonomiese gebied en ander gebiede saam te voeg om selfrespek te handhaaf. Nou ek persoonlik was baie kritisch oor die Broederbond in my vroegere jare. Trouwens, ek het baie sterk kritiek uitgeoefen. Nie in die openbaar nie, maar in persoonlike gesprekke. Nadat ek in die parlement gekom het, in 1948, toe was ek 32 jaar oud, toe het mense my kom nader en gevra of ek nie een lid van die Broederbond wil word nie. Ek het aan die begin gesê, nee, ek wil daar niks meer te doen nie. Maar toe het hulle vir my gesê, mense soos vader Kestel en dokter Van der Merwe, dokter Inje Van der Merwe, en ander vooraanstaande Suid-Afrikaners behoor daaraan. Zelfs een man soos professor Van Rooyen van Potchefstroom, wat een welbekende Afrikaner professor was. Ek het my laat ompraat. En toe het hulle my ingeskryf as een lid, wat ek vir een tyd geblei het. Hulle het my in die parlement is ek gevra, is jy lid van die Broederbond? Ek het gesê ja. Alhoewel, jy nie veronderstel was te sê jy is lid nie. Want het was nie een geheime organisatie, maar het was vertrouwelijk. Later jare het die Broederbond begin ontaard. Louis-Ray het ontstaan, bevoordeling het ontstaan, en uiteindelijk het talle Afrikaners uit die Broederbond bedank, waaronder ek self een is.
Het die Broederbond dan enige invloed uitgeoefen op politieke besluite wat geneem is deur die regering?
Nee, selfs toe ek eerste minister en staatspresident was, is daar nie pogings aangewend om my in 'n drukgang te plaas nie. Ek sou my ook nie daar, dat beweeg het nie. In die parlement was daar die vraag aan my gestel, is jy lid van die Broederbond? Toe sê ek ja. Toe ek daarby gesê, maar ek word nie deur hulle voorgeskryf nie.
Gedurende 'n blaaskans in die onderhoud het meneer Botha verder oor sy gedenkwaardighede uitgebrei. Die kanon was 'n geskenk van die Weermag om sy 14 jaar as minister van verdediging te vier. Hy beskou daardie jare as van die beste in sy lewe en hy was trots op die Weermag se paraatheid en krag.
We were respected by the Defence Forces of France, Great Britain, and even Israel. And Israel has a good defence force.
Why did you think we needed such an incredibly strong defence force?
To a certain extent, we introduced national service to train young men in various directions of life. And secondly, we had to protect our borders and from terrorism. And thirdly, the Defence Force inspired the nation as a whole.
What did you enjoy the most about being Minister of Defence?
I loved the discipline, I loved the youth in it, and we did something that you could see and feel.
Daardie was die jare van kanonne, panservoertuie, gewere en verbeete gevegte, wat hy nog goed onthou. Maar die jare kom en gaan, en P.W. Botha het gewys dat hy by die ouderdom aangepas het. Toe ek hom vra, aan watter geskenk hy nou die meeste waarde heg?
Ek dink hierdie kierie wat ek het.
Hy het
praktische waarde en dus mense wat het uit liefde vir my hier gegee het, toe ek afgetreed as parlementslid.
En van watter leier het P.W. Botha die meeste gehou?
You ask me which prime minister or head of the government I like the best. Dr. Malan. He was an old philosopher. And, oh gentlemen.
Dit word algemeen aanvaar dat P.W. Botha heelwat veranderinge teweeggebring het tydens die 10 jaar wat hy aan hoof van die regering gestaan het. Ek wou van hom weet wat hy as die belangrikste veranderinge beskou en hoekom.
Ek gaan 'n paar vir u noem. In my tyd is die driekamer parlement ingestel na referendum. En daar die driekamer parlement is voorsiening gemaak vir kleurlingstemreg dwars deur die land. En hulle kon hulle eie kamer kry. Daar is ook voorsiening gemaak vir 'n indeerkamer. Met ander woorde, kleerlinge wat nooit die stemreg in die land gehad het nie, het het gekry onder die stelsel. Terwyl die blankes hulle stemreg behou het. Een tweede groot verandering wat tot stand gekom het, was die daarstel van die presidentsraad. Destijds onder die voorzitterskap van meneer Alwin Schlebusch, wat een welbekende openbare figuur was. Hy het ook later gedien as vice-president van Suid-Afrika. En hy leef nog, een goeie vriend van my. Nou die presidentsraad het waardevolle werk gedoen. Hulle moes deur onderlinge beraadslaging, moes hulle die regering adviseer watter constitutionele stappe nodig is om Suid-Afrika op een wijze te bestuur wat hom ordelik sal laat ontwikkel. Daar die presidentsraad het baie goeie werk gedoen. Hy is nou afgeskaf, tot my spyt. Maar dit was een indrukwekkende bijeenkomst om dit bij te woon. En ook hulle beraadslagings was van besondere belang. Afgezien daarvan is die wet op gemengde huwelike gewijzig. Daaroor was ek in een geweldige strijd gewikkel met wijle dokter Andries Treurnig, totdat ek vir hom in die parlement gesê het, dat Moses het een gemengde huwelik aangegaan. En hy het het erken. Ook het ek destijds begin met grootskaalse bewapening van die Weermag. Ek het gedien as minister van verdediging en eerste minister. En ons het die sterkste Weermag in Afrika opgebouw. Een man soos dokter Banda het het regheid in die openbaar gesê. Ons het wapenindustrie tot stand gebring. Met houtmaatskapie soos Atlas en die plofstoffabriek en Somerset West. Soveel so, dat 1000 subcontracteurs het Kriegskorps gehelp om die groot wapenindustrie in Suid-Afrika tot stand te bring. Dit het werk verskaf. Nie net aan blankes nie. Dit het kundigheid bevorder. En dit het selfs aan swart mense en kleurlinge werk verskaf in daardie fabrieke, waaraan hulle met groot blydskap self deelgeneem het.
Was dit ooit u einddoel om 'n een mens een stem verkiesing wat uit die aard van die saak sou lei tot 'n swart meerderheidsregering toe te laat? Het u gedink dat so iets uiteindelik sou moes gebeur as gevolg van druk van alle oorde?
Die begrip een man een stem en the winner takes all is een Westminster begrip. Nou, ons standpunt was, vooral my standpunt, dat die Westminster begrip nie in Suid-Afrika sal pas nie. Ons was nie teen die idee van een mens, een stem in 'n aanvaarbare stelsel nie. En daarom het ek en my vriende wat saam met my gestem het, het ons 'n konfederale systeem vir Suid-Afrika voorgestel, waarin jy een mens, een stem sou hê in 'n konfederale verband, en nie in 'n Westminster verband nie. Nou het ons daartoe oorgegaan om 'n een mens, een stem systeem ingestel, onder die leiding van die mense wat daar was, en daar die hele idee van 'n nuwe stelsel is ingevoer. Ek dink dit is eintlik 'n nabootsing van die Amerikaanse systeem.
En u het nie vertroue daaraan nie?
Ek het nie vertroue daaraan gehad nie. Ek het die aand na televisie gesit en kyk toe my opvolger, meneer de Klerk, in Amerika gepraat het in die teenwoordigheid van president Bush, die ou president Bush, die huidige president se pa. En daar het hy gesê, we are following an irreversible policy. Well, I had to see irreversible policy gevolg met die resultaat dat ons nou in an irreversible situation sit van chaos.
Die verkiesing het 1994 toe gebeur en die ANC het met 'n groot meerderheid gewen. Daar is sekere mense wat F.W. de Klerk as 'n soort verraaier beskou, wat die wit man uitverkoop het. Wat is u mening? Was daar vir hom enige alternatief?
Ek het onder daai selfde druk verkeer. En ons het dit probeer weerstaan, deur sanksies te beveg, deur aan te hou praat oor konfederale systeme. Ek het selfs 'n toer in Europa onderneem om dit te gaan verduidelik aan leiers soos mevrou Thatcher, Kohl, Craxi van Italië, die Switserse regering, die Belgiese regering. Ek was bewus daarvan dat daar geweldige druk is, maar ek dink my navolgers het swak geword. En hulle het begin heel met die ANC. Van die begin tyd af, het 'n man soos generaal Herzog nie met die ANC geheel nie. Dr. Malang het nie met die ANC geheel nie. Selfs generaal Smuts het nie met die ANC geheel nie. Nou hierdie mense het begin, alhoewel hulle dit ontken het, het hulle met die ANC begin samensprekings voer by Kodesa, en ek dink Kodesa was 'n flater en 'n rampspoedige bijeenkomst.
Maar die aard van die saak, was het nie nodig om, as mense daar die woord geheel wil gebruik, om samensprekings te voer met die ANC, om een skikking, een soort van een skikking te bereik?
Samensprekings met ander leiers van gemeenskappe is wenslik. Dit was in my tyd wenslik, ek het dit ook gedoen. Weet u dat ons in die Uniegebou, het ons binnen in die Uniegebou dit so laat verander, dat daar plek was vir bijeenkomste, waar lande soos die van Transkei, Siskei, Maputo-Tswana, Kasengulu en andere in Natal bijeengekom het, om samensprekings te voer tussen leiers van verskillende kulturele groepe in Suid-Afrika. So samensprekings het ek altyd verwelkom. Maar met die ANC kon jy nie samensprekings voer nie. Om die eenvoudige rede, die ANC is 'n communistisch beheerde organisasie. Al die jare, en nou nog.
Het jy enige waardering vir hoe meneer Mandela die land regeer het na sy oorname?
Meneer Mandela, terwyl hy in die gevangenis was, by Pearl, het gevra om my te spreek Ek het hom ontmoet in tuinhuis. Daar het ek hom gewaarsku teen die magte in die huidige wêreld wat invloed uitoefen op organisaties soos die ANC. Ek het hom gewaarsku onder andere teen kommunisme. Ek het nie daar het ek nie rekening gehou met die feit dat hy self voor die hof verklaar het dat hy weet hoe om 'n goeie kommunist te wees nie. Daarna het hy my hier kom spreek in hierdie selfde kamer. Hy het daar gesit en na my vrou vir hom koffie bedien het en toebroodjies het hy gesê dat hy wil vir my versoek rig. Toen zei ik, wat is dit? Toen zei hij, wil hij, ik moet terugkomen in die politiek. Toen zei ik van hem, ik kan niet terugkomen in die politiek, nie, omdat dan werk ik met jou samen, wat fundamenteel met mijn verschil. En ik heb hem weer gewaarschuwd tegen die machten, wat hem zo beheer. Hij is, geloof ik, door baie van die machten zo beïnvloed, dat hy een pad geloop het, wat uiteindelik in die vorm van sy navolgers rampspoedig vir die land geword het.
Maar daar was daarom nie een bloedbad in die land na die verkiesing nie, nee. Ek meen, dit het hy daarom reg gekry.
Daar was nie een bloedbad nie, maar daar is een ander prijs betaal. Daar het wel geweld in Suid-Afrika met sy medewete plaasgevind, soos die bomme in Pretoria, en soos die terroriste wat oor die landsgrense gekom het, en mense hier vermoor het. Ek dink bijvoorbeeld aan die geweldige onrust wat daar op die Witwatersrand plaasgevind het, waar mense met bande aan die brand gesteek het, en mense met brandende bande om hulle nekke gehang is. Daar die geweld het plaasgevind, net voordat hy aan bewind gekom het. En ek het vir hom gesê, jy moet geweld veroordeel, as 'n vorm van bedinging. Hy het dit nie gedoen nie.
Wat dink jy van president Mbeki se leierskap? Vergeleken met die van Mandela.
Laat me eerst dit sê. Ek het 3 gesprekke met meneer Mandela gehad, met die gevolg ek kon peil wat hy wil sê en wat hy nie wil sê nie, of wat hy wil aanvaar en nie aanvaar nie. Ek ken meneer Mbeki nie persoonlik nie. Maar ek weet, uit wat aan my meegedeel is, dat hy is opgelei onder communistische bewind. En ek weet een ander ding, dat uit die latere broederbond een samensprekings met hom gevoer, toe hy, voordat hy president geword het. Hy was in Amerika, toe daar die samensprekings met hom gevoer is, en ek was uiters ontsteld daaroor destijds. Ek het die persoon wat met hom die samensprekings gevoer het in Amerika, het ek laat kom na die Unie gebouw toe in Pretoria. En ek het hom aangespreking van hom gesê, jy is op een gevaarlike pad. Meneer Mbeki is natuurlijk een communist. En ek dink nie, hy sal het ontken nie.
Maar meneer Thabo Mbeki word in baie kringe as 'n kapitalist beskou.
Communisme is staatskapitalisme. En staatskapitalisme is uitbuiting van mense. En dit beleef ons, dat communistische leiders in Suid-Afrika word nou skielik rijk. Daar is bekendes in Gauteng, daar is andere, selfs Ramaphosa, wat gehelp het om die Codesa-affaire te betlink. Hy is, verstaan ek, vandag een van die welvarende mense.
Meneer Botha, hoe beskou u die beleid van regstellende aksie wat ook swart bemagtiging en transformasie behels? Is dit nodig en word dit reg toegepas?
Laat my dit sê dat soos ons nou beleef regstellende aksie, affirmative action soos het genoem word, is 'n swak vorm van swak apartheid. Dit vernietig mense se kanse om diens te lewer in Suid-Afrika. Dit verwilder mense met kundigheid uit Suid-Afrika uit, wat sê, hier is nie vir ons die toekoms nie, omdat daar word teen ons gediskrimineer. Regstellende aksie is myns insiens 'n baie rampspoedige beleid wat toegepas word. Selfs ook die swart bemagtiging wat nou weer oor die rasse tamboer gegooi word. En ek het gedag, ons is nou nie een rasse staat nie, nou is ons werkelijk een, dat in alles word swart bemagtiging ingesleep, en blanke boere se plase moet prysgegee word, en blanke boere word vermoor. En die regering doen nie veel daaraan nie. En transformatie, waarin transformeer ons? Na een beter systeem? Wat is die systeem? Wat is daar wat verbeter op wat ons vandag het? Ons parlement is wel, staan die gebouwen nog daar, wat in my tyd grootliks tot stand gekom het. Maar ek was nog nooit weer daar nie. So nou en dan kyk ek op televisie na die samensprekings daar en het lyk vir my, dit is een leserij van toesprake.
Het die enige boodskap vir jong Suid-Afrikaners wat die land verlaat of daaraan dink om dit te doen, omdat hulle nie werk in Suid-Afrika kan kry nie?
Sover my kennis strek, is daar duisende jong Suid-Afrikaners in Londen. Daar is jong Afrikaners in Amerika. Daar is jong Amerikaners in Australië. Onder hulle is daar van my familie. En hulle is bekwaam. Die feit dat hulle daarheen gegaan het, bewys dat hulle word verwelkom daar. My inligting is dat die Britse, Australiese, Nieu-Seelandse vertegenwoordiging in Suid-Afrika gaan uit hulle pad om vriendelik te wees vir hierdie jong Suid-Afrikaners, omdat hulle bate is as immigrante. Nou, die feit dat sulke mense verlore gaan, beteken dat ons verloor kundigheid. En daardie kundigheid moet eerder gebruik word om in Suid-Afrika ontwikkeling te help tot stand bring, werkverskaffing te help verseker, ook vir die werkloze swartes wat al hoe meer word en wat hulpeloos op die straatdoeke sit en nie weet wat om te doen nie.
Meneer Botha, het u enige raad vir president Thabo Mbeki oor sy hantering van minderheidsgroepe en dan vir al die Afrikaner met sy strewe na 'n eie identiteit en taal?
Ek sou sê my eerste stukkie raad aan hom is, sonder dat ek nou met hom persoonlik kan praat, is wees versigtig vir diegene wat jou raad gee. Ek weet van mense wat kruip voor hom. Ek weet van sogenaamde akademici wat ek geen vertroue in het nie, wat vir hom allerhande gedagtes probeer inprent. Los daardie raadgevers, soek raadgevers wat werklik weet wat in Suid-Afrika se belang is en wat eerlik en reguit sal adviseer.
En as u sy raadgever was, wat sou u sê?
Ek sal hom op verskillende punte sê ek, so vir hom sê, hierdie wapenwet, wat die regering ingedien het, moet gekanseleer word. Die wapenwet is 'n skandaal. As jy na die geskiedenis kyk, dan was die Afrikaner veral geken deur sy Bybel, deur sy wapen, deur sy kommandostelsel. Daardie dinge word nou in die gedrang gebring deur die wetgewing wat hierdie regering maak en administratiewe stappe. Dit moet reggemaak word. Daar moet drasties daaroor gehandel word en teruggekeer word na gesonde kommandostelsel. Die beoefening van wapens selfs vir sportdoeleindes en die terugkeer na die Bybel as die boek van alle boeke.
Is Afrikaans 'n stervende taal, soos wat baie mense dink, of sal dit behoue bly? Al stuur baie Afrikaners deesdae hulle kinders na Engelssprekende skole toe en word Engels deur die regering bevoordeel.
As jy oor taal praat, moet jy oor moedertaal praat. Nergens in die wêreld kan gesonde opleiding plaasvind sonder moedertaal nie. Ook in Suid-Afrika. Moedertaalonderwys het enorme bydraes gelewer in Suid-Afrika. Want taal is die spoor waarop mense gedagtes sweef. So een taal maak een volk. Ook Engelse taal in Suid-Afrika. En daarom geloof ek in Engels moedertaal vir Engels sprekende kinders. Ek geloof Afrikaanse moedertaal vir Afrikaanse kinders. Ek geloof in Zulu moedertaal vir Zulu kinders. Ek glo dit vir die Sotho kinders. Ek glo dit vir die Wendas. Want dit is deel van die konsep van kulturele konfederale systeem wat in Suid-Afrika 'n ander kleur, 'n ander gesindheid tussen mense sal bring as die huidige stelsel.
So jy dink die Afrikaner sal die sogenaamde aanslag op Afrikaans kan oorleef? En hoe?
Baie sal ondergaan in hierdie stryd. Baie is besig om onder te gaan. Sommige mense speel bankrot. Andere verlaat die land. Maar een klein minderheid sal miskien oorbly, wat sal voortgaan met die geveg, soos Arthur Conan Doyle gesê het, gedetermineerd om te oorwin.
Korrupsie, meneer Botha, almal vind het verstommend hoe wyd verspreid dit in die land is. Die ANC beweer dat dit veel erger was toe die Nasionale Party regeer het, maar dat dit net baie effektief verbloem was. Wat is u reaksie hierop?
Ek het, voordat ek in 'n magsposisie gekom het, het ek geweet wat in ander kringe plaasvind in Suid-Afrika. Laat my dit sê. Kom ons kyk 'n bietjie terug. 'N man soos Weyler-generaal Herzog was bekend vir sy eerlikheid, ook teenoor die swart mense. Sy opvolger Dr. Malang was 'n godsman, het geen korrupsie geduld nie. Maar waar korrupsie onder die aandag gekom het, is opgetree. Selfs in my tyd later het ons so opgetree dat die kabinetsminister moes bedank, omdat hy oneerlik opgetree het. Een ander een het ek laat bedank, ek wil nie nou name noem nie, maar ek het hom ingeroep, en meneer de Klerk weet wie sy. Ek het daai man laat bedank, omdat hy onreelmatig opgetreed. Maar hy het my so goed gesind gewees daarna, dat hy my kom groet het hier. En toe het hy vir my gesê, hy spyt oor die klein foutjie wat hy gemaakt het.
En hoewel af is u, meneer Botha, na so 50 jaar in die politiek?
Nee, wat, kyk, ek is nie ryk nie. Ek het nooit eintlik geld versamel, omdat ek lief is vir geld nie. Dis my agtergrond. Ek het in huis groot geword waar dit nie 'n groot rol gespeel het nie. Ek sal nooit daarby kom. My moeder was 'n groot voorstander van sendingwerk. Sendingwerk in Botswana, sendingwerk in Zambië, sendingwerk tot in die Sahara. En sy dit ondersteun. Om die waarheid te sê, sy het in duie gestort achter die sendingbazaar tafel. En kort daarna is sy oorlede. My pa, sy gesindheid was so, dat hy selfs vir 'n swart man een daad bewys het wat altyd by my thuis bly. Ons het op die plaas, waar ek groot geword het, het ons een swart man gehad, waardige swart man, met sy familie, met die naam van Kameel. En toe het daar in Suid-Afrika een wending gekom, in 1932, het Suid-Afrika van die goudstandaard afgegaan en na papiergeld oorgeskakel. Toe het my pa vir Kameel laat kom na sy huis en vir hom gesê, ek wil vir jou raad gee. Ons gaan nou een anders geldstelsel gebruik. Jy moet jou goud vir my bring, dat ek jou na die bank toe kan neem vir die omruiling, want jy kan nie meer goud gebruik nie. En weet jy ook aan Kameel het gekom? En weet jy hoeveel gouden ponde het hy in bottels gehad? Wat hy op die muurplate van sy strooihuis gebere het. 6000 gouden kruierponde. En dit is omgeruil en hy kon daarna met sy papiergeldjies aangaan. Dit is die gesindheid. Ons het nooit geld versamel, omdat ons geld gierig was nie. Maar ons het geglo in diens. My eepa het die Anglo-Boereoorlog dwars deur geveg, sonder om oor te gee. My moeder was in 'n konsentrasiekamp. Sy het haar kinders daarna grootgemaak. Ek het aan die universiteit gegaan, in 'n baie moeilike tyd. En ek het onder die invloed van mense beland, soos Dr. D.F. Malherbe, die groot Afrikaanse skrywer. En selfs een Engelssprekende professor het vir my een naam gegee wat ek vandag nog het, namelijk P.W. So ek het nie geldgierig gewees nie. En ek sê nie ons moet geldgierig wees nie. Maar ons kan in hierdie mooi land geweldig mooi lewe verseker vir mense. Ons moet net leer om diensbaar te wees.
Ons beweeg einde se kant toe, meneer Botha, en daar's 'n vraag wat moet gestel word. Onlangse onthullings in die Waarheid en Versoening Kommissie, asook elders, het bewyse gelewer van onmenslike geweld teenoor opponente van die nasionale party regering. Was dit ooit regeringsbeleid, was die leierskorps daarvan bewus, en hoe dink u behoort ons hierdie deel van ons geskiedenis vandag te verwerk?
Laat my begin deur eers te verwys na die feit dat ek nie voor die waarheidskommissie verskyn het nie. Ek het destyds gesê, dit is 'n sirkus. Maar, Intussen het ek met die hulp van regsgeleerdes vrae van die kommissie skriftelik beantwoord. En ons het 2000 getikte bladsye A-vorm papier het ons aan hulle gelever. Ek merk nie dat hulle dit gepubliseer het nie. Hulle het wel ander dinge gepubliseer deur allerhande misdade uit te krap en dit dan aan die vorige regering vas te noop. My voorganger en ek sou nooit mense die reg gegee het of opdrag gegee het om moord te pleeg en mense te martel nie. Ons sou dit nie toegelaat het nie. Trouwens, die kabinette waarin ek voorzitter was, sy notulis is beskikbaar. Het is vandag beskikbaar, onder my naam by die Instituut vir Eietijdse Geschiedenis. Ek hoor later, ander mense se kopieë is vernietig. Ek weet nie wat daarvan geword het nie, maar myne is beskikbaar. Daai notulis kan nagegaan word en daar sal gevind word dat ons nie vir ons besig houd deur opdragte verwandade te gee nie. Daar was wel mense wat verkeerd opgetree het. En in enige gemeenskap is daar mense wat dink hulle kan beter doen deur hulle eie kop te volg. En ek veroordeel dit.
Meneer Botha, ten slotte, u was 50 jaar in die politiek, waarvan u ook vir 10 jaar die leier van die land was. Daarna het u ook vir 16 jaar enorme veranderinge in die land beleef. Watter boodskap en raad het u vandag vir wat deesdae die reënboognasie genoem word?
In die eerste plek, toe ek die woord gehoor het oor die radio, oor die televisie van reënboognasie, het ek gelag. Want daar is nie so'n ding soos een reënboognasie nie. Die kleure van die reënboog en die kleure van die mense van Suid-Afrika verskil soos dag by die nag. Daar is nergens in die wêreld een reënboognasie nie. Daar mag enkele elemente van die reënboog wees, maar dan moet ons dit so stel. Ek sê die reënboognasie bestaan nie, maar die nasie van culturele minderheidsgroepe bestaan wel. En elkeen van die culturele minderheidsgroepe het 'n drang om homself te wees. Ek dink degelike onderwys en opleiding is noodsaaklik. Maar dan moet ons die vermoë wat daar is, aanwend. En die vermoë wat vandag in die buitenland sit, moet teruggebring word. Hulle moet kom om ons land weer op 'n koers te plaas. 'N koers van selfonderzoek, van toewyding, van culturele soeke om onsself uit te lewe. Want elkeen van hierdie culturele minderheidsgroepe moet respek hê vir mekaar. En ons moet 'n stelsel ontwerp waarbinne dit moontlik is. Jy vind dit in ander lande van die wêreld. Ek het kommissies van ondersoek na Europa gestuur. Sommige van daai mense leef nog, hulle het verslae uitgebring. Ek wil name noem. Daar is die van professor Ich Rodemach, een welbekende constitutionele deskundige. Hy het gegaan en hy het baie interessante verslae uitgebring oor wat in Suid-Afrika moet gedoen word. Daar is een man wat saam met my 7 jaar in die selfde kantoor gewerk het, Dr. Daan Prinsloo. Ek het hom gestuur saam met anderen om Europese lande te besoek. Maar ons het afgewyk van die stelsel wat uit Europa uit kon kom. En na die Westminster stelsel en ons kiele afgedruk is hier in Suid-Afrika deur oorlog, het ons voortgegaan na CODESA met die irreversible policy en ons het 'n hartoorplanting ondergaan uit Amerika uit, waarmee ek nie saamstem nie. Ons jong mense moet nie vergoed uit die buitenland, in die buitenland bly nie. My raad aan hulle is, versamel kennis, versamel kundigheid, en as jou liefde jou toelaat, kom na jou land, en laat ons veg om 'n nuwe gesindheid in Suid-Afrika en nuwe moontlikhede hier te skep.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.